So here we go. Round six. The MotoGP World Championship at Silverstone. About to get underway.
Great start from Ben Speed from that front row. He gets ahead of Philip Bautista.
Hello and welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 324 for Wednesday, the 20th of June, 2012. My name is Jules Cisek. I'm in California. And with me is Martin Darlington, who has just wrapped up an amazing weekend at Silverstone. Welcome back.
Hello, Jules. Hello, everyone. It was fantastic. It was really, really good. It was three great races, which we will talk about probably in some depth. And being my second year with the media accreditation, I was a bit less starstruck than last year. And last year, I was David Emmett's shadow, and David took me around by the hand and showed me how you do this journalist stuff. So I was a bit more able this year to run on my own two feet. I had a great time, met some more amazing people there. It was great to see Andrew Wheeler again and Dr. Martin Raines and all sorts of people. So, yeah, it was just an amazing weekend. And finally, we actually got a decent British race without the weather playing a part. Although amazing. I have to mention the weather. I've just been back to work for 3 days, glorious weather, and first day off, it's raining. And tonight, I'm driving to Sunderland to see Bruce Springsteen in concert in a football stadium, and the forecast is heavy rain throughout the entire evening. So it's like,
whoa.
Thanks.
Wow. Well, that could be an interesting show. I didn't know he could still sing. Well, actually, he never could sing, but...
Well, he sort of shouts in tune, doesn't he?
Yes.
But I think he's up there with the Rolling Stones, Beatles sort of level people of, if you get the chance, you got to see him.
Yeah, I bet it's going to be an amazing show. Well, yeah. good for you, man. That's cool. Well,
when Born in the USA album came out in the 80s, I made a slightly off-the-wall comment to a mate that's a future president of the United States, because he's always been very politically aware.
Yes.
And I keep waiting for it, and he sort of dabbled, doesn't he? But I keep waiting for Springsteen to say, do you know what? The Democrats need a bit of a personality, so I'm going to go. I mean, obviously, they've got Barack Obama at the moment, but I don't know. Yeah, I'd have thought he'd have got more involved.
Yeah, I don't think he's really electable, but we'll see.
probably not. But his opening concert or his inaugural ceremony would be quite good, wouldn't it?
Oh, my God, yeah.
Strap a guitar on and do it himself.
And every State of the Union address would be.
And he could have some fun. He could see how many of his song titles he could slip into each speech.
Baby, We're Born to Run. All right. Yeah,
that's the one.
All right. So you brought back some fantastic material from various people. We're going to play that later in the show. Let's get started with some listener feedback.
Sure. Do we just want to go through the interviews we've got so people know what to look forward to?
Yeah, okay, go for it.
We'll do the listener feedback and a little bit of a roundup on miscellaneous news, bits and pieces. Then we've got Lucio Ceccanello, the team principal of LCR. Then we've got Hervé Poncherel, team principal of Tech Trois. And both of those guys, really, really open, engaging, spoke very well, and I just asked a question, sit back and let them roll, and they were fantastic. We got a few minutes with Colin Edwards, which is just always gold. That was pre-race, post-qualifying. And then we spoke to Dr. Martin Raines, who's the official statistician of Fedorna and MotoGP, on a kind of state of the nation, you know, where we are, where we've come from and where we're going. And then after the race, we got to speak briefly, but very interestingly, with Andrea Dovizioso and Stefan Bradl. And then right at the end of the show, we've got I got to chat to Ben Challenger, Olympic high jump hopeful. His trials are this weekend. I'm sure people remember his interview recently. Huge bike fan. And with him was Ewan Thomas, who's another British athlete who has already retired, but he's often seen on commentary. And he's massive. He's about 6'4", huge. But he was a very successful 400-meter runner. And so it's them just chatting about coming up. And then because I could, my company have the contract for Silverstone, and Captain Johnny Cutler was the duty air ambulance pilot for the weekend. So I popped in to see Johnny, nick a coffee and some sandwiches. And we just had a couple of minutes on what the role of the air ambulance is at motorsport events.
Excellent. Yeah. But first of all, we'll do listener feedback. We've got one very interesting email from Dale, who didn't give us a last name, so just Dale. And he said, listening to your latest podcast regarding Johnny Ray, you possibly forgot to consider what happened to Edwards. If Edwards can win two Superbike titles within 2 years and not garner a factory MotoGP ride, what chance does Ray have? Remember that when Edwards won both titles, the economy was excellent, and World Superbike still had a factory Honda backing and therefore HRC level interest. Also, this was at a time when MotoGP crowd believed the move to four strokes could open a door for World Superbike riders lacking traditional European two-stroke backgrounds. And today, with the economy, lack of support in World Superbikes, and the overall lack of World Superbike level talent, competitiveness in MotoGP, speeds notwithstanding, consistently, I doubt a factory ride is forthcoming for any Superbike type rider, given MotoGP 2 and 3. Moto 2 and 3. And I think this is a great point. You know, it's... there may have been promises made to Johnny Ray. Jim and I talked about that last week, but that's all fizzled in the last few years. Everything's changed. The whole game is completely different. You know, I mean, he can get a CRT. You guys did a lot of talking with Hervé and Dr. Martin Raines about CRTs and their place in the sport over the next few years. You know, and
well, interestingly, I got in a right Twitter yes. storm yesterday.
Yeah, I was following that. I was following that.
Ian Wheeler and then Chris Pike, who is Johnny Ray's crew chief.
Yes.
And they were basically saying CRT is not attractive to riders. Now, I absolutely defer to the massively greater experience of Ian Wheeler and Chris Pike and their intimate knowledge of riders compared to mine. But I just think, I don't know. I defer to their experience, but I don't defer to their arguments, because I still think if you want to get into MotoGP and the only opening is CRT, you'll go to that CRT. And if you can be the lead runner in that CRT, you know, then you're going to go, well, somewhere, I'm going to get noticed.
Yeah, exactly.
You're in the paddock. You're on the right tracks. You're racing against the guys who you want to compete with on similar prototype machinery. But thinking back to last year at Silverstone, when Julian Ryder was on stage with Eugene Laverty, and someone from the crowd said, you know, Eugene, do you want to come to MotoGP? He said, yeah, of course, it's the target for everybody, every rider. And Julian Ryder was asked what he thought, and very bravely stood next to Eugene and said, why would a MotoGP team manager employ someone who's regularly being beaten by people?
MotoGP has-beens.
Yeah, no longer considered fast enough to be a MotoGP. I mean, let's look at it. Can anyone really imagine Carlos Checa or Max Biaggi or Marco Melandri even coming back to MotoGP and winning races? No. So it's kind of... And also thinking about... I remember the MotoGP... Moto2 comment at the end by Dale. And I remember thinking, well, World Supersport and Moto2, that'll be quite a good crossover. Now, it's early days yet, but Gino Rea, who was running right at the front of World Supersport, is struggling to score points in Moto2. So
yeah.
Look at
Safawaglu. Safawaglu's another great example of whatever it is, whether it's the talent field or just the format of the series, it just doesn't work, you know?
Yeah. But I do think, you know, I just can't see where an opening would be for Johnny Ray, other than, like you say, CRT, yeah. which could be a win. Also, I think, you know, I mean, basically, Ian and Chris, they weren't, because I felt a bit under siege at one point. I was like, well, come on, what's your alternative to it? And Ian made the point. He said, no, we're not talking about, you know, viable alternatives to CRT, or is it a good thing or a bad thing or a necessary thing? We were just saying it won't attract riders. And I thought, hang on, say you're Tom Lee. Where's Tom Leethy going to go next year? Where is he going to find a seat in MotoGP?
Well, let's see if he wins a championship. Maybe that'll open some doors.
I mean, I used him as an example because at the moment leading the championship is Marc Marquez.
Yeah.
And we know he's going to get a seat in MotoGP.
Yep.
And he probably won't have to go through the CRT proving pool. But if you're Tom Leethy and there's no prototype seat offered, but someone offers you a CRT ride, surely you look at people like Yanni Hernandez, Ivan Silva, without being rude to these guys, Mattia Pessini, and think, last year I was consistently a dozen places higher than these guys. So if they're only 3 seconds off the tail end of the prototypes, or sorry, a second to 2 seconds off the tail end of the prototypes.
Yeah. Now you're starting to get into some interesting things that were actually said in the Dr. Lance interview.
I'm running away with myself.
And it's a very interesting point that he makes.
Yeah.
You know,
we can examine that more after Martin Raines has said, before I try and claim credit for thoughts that I've stolen from him.
Nice. You got to do this next one.
We had, this was via Facebook, William Butch Irwin sent in, and I missed some of these because, well, I obviously was watching it at the circuit. I've watched it back since, and I was forced to watch it on BBC. But these were the Charlie Coxisms, and he listed a load of them. One of them was, any tougher, he'd rust, which is actually not a bad one. Someone else went off like a harpoon. Like a pig through hot straw. Yeah. And this is cliche world. He opened the door, a yawning chasm.
Mm.
Can Spies hold him off or will the boss come past? That's presumably with Lorenzo behind him. That's overclubbed him. I have no idea what overclubbing something means. It's all over, Red Rover.
Love that. Love that.
Happy Chappy Bautista. Only rental cars seem to rev higher. I remember that one. He's in Scone City. What? He'll be able to jog on water on the way home. And yeah, he can ride at hands and heels from here on in. What does that mean?
Was that after a crash?
No. This was a reference made when Lorenzo had pulled the gap. And he was basically saying he can take it easier.
Got it.
He can ride at hands and heels from here on. Now, does that mean ride it like a cruiser? So you're sort of leaning back with your, I don't know.
All right. So here's to Charlie Cox and William Butch Irwin for sending that in. There.
Oh, congratulations to them with the click click. But he didn't say shot the fox at any stage. I was most disappointed. I'm not sure anyone had a nightmare, whether it be in a bubble car or elsewhere. Interesting. I was in the queue to get another of the free coffees in the media centre, stood behind Charlie Cox, and he dropped, I think it was eye drops or something. He dropped on the floor as he got his money out to pay for his actually quite healthy looking lunch. And I picked him up and handed it to him. He went, oh, thanks, mate. And I thought, oh, it's him. And he glanced at my T-shirt because I have a MotoPod T-shirt. And I thought, okay, I'm about to be punched in the face by an angry Australian. he doesn't get any better, though. He's still Steve Parrish, half his job. I'm sure the producers say, right, Steve, you know, put your colour bits in. Say about what you're saying, but, you know, do keep an eye on what Charlie's saying and be ready to correct him when you need to, which will be several times a race.
Right.
He's still having to do that. Well, then we had Grant Heffernan.
Yeah, Grant Heffernan wrote in and said some interesting comments from Spies post-qualifying regarding his riding style. Sounds like someone tried to fix, in quotes, elbows, and in the process made a mess of things. A fifth in the race was at least better than what's become more typical of late. Any more insight into Spies' comments? And you know, and the thing is that I listened to the post QP conference,
and
I wasn't sure what he was talking about. And I listened to it again, and I still wasn't. And I actually then like captured the audio part when he's talking and listened to it a couple of times. I realized that was very perceptive of Grant, because he basically picked up on the fact that Spies is talking about how he's been fighting the bike, trying to ride it the way it wanted to be ridden, and then and then deciding to instead to go back to where he was last year. And maybe it was just, maybe Grant was reading too much into it, but maybe Ben is being, you know, kind of diplomatic about it. But maybe he was being kind of forced to say, hey, listen, you need to change your writing style, blah, blah, blah. Here's, try these settings, da, da, da. Losing confidence for the bike,
yeah,
causing the snowball effect, you know, and then just saying, you know what, let's go back to the start. Let's go back to the beginning, the things that I was comfortable with. And boom, right away, Catalunya wasn't for the, you know, the little runoff. He was back, you know, so interesting.
Yeah, and he certainly seemed, I mean, he had another crash during practice, and he's never been a crasher. And I was thinking, oh, all that damage, but he did do it. He did a great job. He did a great job all weekend. And, mm-hmm. And it was good to see.
Yeah. The crash didn't seem to set him back at all. Like it was earlier in the season, you know,
but I guess it may have been one of those, right. I know exactly what I did wrong. I
exactly.
know what,
that's exactly
what happened
right.
there.
Instead of, what the hell just happened, you know?
Yeah.
Totally hear you.
Yeah, go on. You go with this one, because this was from last week. Sam Dixon wrote in.
Yes, he did. He wrote in. He said, glad to hear that Josh Hayes discussion in episode 323. I've been thinking a long time that he has earned a ride in the World Championship based on his past experience and what he's been able to do in the AMA. However, that ride has failed to come as of yet. I'm beginning to think the issue is the AMA as is viewed by those outside the U.S. Is it possible that the AMA championship is seen as a bit of a minor league or inferior to other national championships? I know Matt Mladen had some world-level rides, but never seemed to stick. Or did Mladen prefer the AMA championship? I'm just curious about this because it seems Josh Hayes hasn't been given the chance I believe he deserves. Would it be possible for Graves to field a privateer effort in World Superbikes? Point is the perception of the AMA the issue? And Jim put in a little note saying that Mladen was making millions, and it's true, he was really making millions in the AMA and had no incentive to leave. He was on a mission, make bank, retire, and move on. To which I had to make the comment, mission accomplished.
Yeah.
his brief intermission as a second-tier rider on the Kajiva in 93 and then being usurped by Kaczynski sealed his thoughts, which is exactly the kind of, like, I remember him with that crazy, you know, platinum blonde hair that he had back at the time. And, you know, I think I think Sam is partially right. I think that the AMA is considered like all national series, either they're considered as feeders to world championships or a place where guys who can't hack it there, you know, go to make their mark. AMA is not a series that's American rider only. Obviously, we have riders from Colombia, we have riders from Spain, we have riders from Australia, obviously, US-based riders. So it's a national series because it's run in the US, but everybody comes in from all over the place, same as BSB and Australian superbikes.
I do think that BSB and AMA are suffering a little bit from, it's a bit of a paradox or a catch-22. To make themselves more affordable and more entertaining, they've made rule adjustments to basically reduce costs. But in doing so, they've separated themselves further from World Superbike spec and even further from any kind of MotoGP comparison. So the jump has got a bit greater. I mean, certainly one of the points made about the new BSB rules this year, which are effectively Evo, as we had last year, moving more towards Superstock, we won't get... We may get some wildcard riders going from the BSB paddock to the World Superbike to ride a World Superbike, but they won't be going with their BSB bikes like they have in previous years and had some great success doing that. So,
he's talking about the perception of.
Yeah, exactly. So the perception is that AMA and BSB, I think, suffering from the same. Even though they've got more entertaining, they've done it at the cost of moving further away. So it's an even bigger jump. So someone doing well in AMA.
But, you know, Josh gets on a MotoGP bike and finishes seventh at Valencia. So, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
You know.
Yeah.
I mean,
in Josh's case.
Go ahead.
I think in Josh's case, I think it's an age issue.
I was just going to say, I mean, he's not a young, young guy anymore, and it'd be very difficult for a superbike. See, we're talking about superbikes here, right? He's not. He wouldn't be the oldest guy in superbikes.
Well, no,
you know.
But if you notice, the oldest guys in superbikes have come from MotoGP.
Yeah.
They're stepping down. He'd still be perceived as stepping up. And I don't know if anyone would take that sort of punt on someone stepping up at that age.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah. I think there's a lot more to it than just, you know, I think there's definitely a team out there that would love to have Josh race in superbikes for them. But there's a lot of other things that are involved. You know, Josh has got a loyalty to Graves. Graves, I don't think is really going to be able to muster an effort for superbikes. It would have to be somebody else. There's politics, there's money, there's all sorts of things that we just don't know about that may be blocking that kind of move. And maybe, you know, so there's lots of stuff going on, and I think that if it happens, it's because he wants to make it happen. I think if he really wants to make it happen, he probably will make it happen, you know?
Yeah. I mean, he's also, of course, he's his wife has her own racing career, Melissa Paris, and he may not want to be on the other side of the world from her for that much. You know, he might be like thinking,
That's what I mean. There's so many things we don't know about, personal, political, you know, salaries, who knows, right? So,
yeah. We heard from Ray Jepson, who said, I just want to toss some comments in about what's happening to the rider market, TT0, and something I find overlooked in Moto2. And I will protest the overlooking of that in Moto2 when we get to it.
Yep.
He said he's surprised that 95% of the talk around Casey Stoner's departure is focused on Marquez. To begin with, Honda brought Stoner in because Pedrosa has yet shown the ability to be a championship contender between injuries and periods of being off the winning pace. Is his seat really that safe, considering that it's doubtful that Honda will pluck as proven a commodity as Stoner? He's talking about Pedrosa's seat there. Mm-hmm. Also, there's a lot of focus on what to do with Marquez, but there are three GP riders that could take a factory seat next year and who have shown the potential to be aliens: Crutchlow, Dovi, and Bradle. I think it's a far more difficult decision than just how to bring Marquez in.
Now, right. Let's separate this thing into the three sections. So,
yeah. Well, I mean, there's been so much talk, and it emerged at Silverstone, and it would appear that we're going to get an announcement shortly that the rookie rule will indeed be suspended, right, or will be binned.
And there's been shortly a few minutes after that, there'll be an announcement from Repsol that they've signed Marquez.
Yes. Yeah. Now, we believe that that's already happened. That's a done deal.
Right.
Won't surprise anybody. And immediately there was the media center is a fascinating place, as you'll know, Jules, to just sit and listen to the discussions between the Julian Riders and the Dennis Noyes and the Martin Raines and the Michael Scotts and the Matt Burts and all these guys. And you just sit there and listen and think, yes, I can say that and pretend it was my thought. but basically, there was an immediate acknowledgement that the reaction would be, oh, well, yeah, if you want to get on in this MotoGP world, you really need a Spanish passport, preferably a Catalan background, you know, and then immediately followed by, but it's got nothing to do with his nationality. It's got to do with him. Now, it has got to do with his nationality in the sense of Repsol sponsoring him because they're a Spanish company, so they sponsor Spanish riders. And they've had these are our chosen few. And we've got Pedrosa in MotoGP. Okay, obviously Stoner as well, but Pedrosa with the personal element, Marquez and Maverick Vinales. Well, you look at them, apart from, okay, Danny's not won a world title, but he is one of the fastest riders in the championship. We've got Marquez, who's one of the outstanding talents in Moto2, and Vinales the same in Moto3. So that's not really surprising. And it was quite surprising to see yesterday Ben Spies tweeting to Colin Edwards saying, Rocky Rule going to be sacked. You know, what do you know? I've obviously got the wrong passport. And Colin sort of sympathizing, although several people that then responded with, well, that sounds a little bit like sour grapes.
But like, if you look at where is Marquez going to go as a satellite to a satellite team, it would have hurt any satellite team that he would go to. We discussed this actually a bit last week with Jim, is that we'd end up with this Repsol sponsored rider who's perpetually going to be sponsored by Repsol, you know, pushing out other sponsors from a satellite team for one season. And then that team then has to go and try to get the sponsors back. You know, isn't being suspended just because it's Marquez. It's being suspended because it doesn't make any sense.
Not anymore. And it was brought in, I believe, to give the satellite teams an opportunity to have the arriving talent for a year, like Ben Spies at Tech Tour.
Yeah,
it raised Tech Tour's profile. And it also took a little bit of pressure off Ben. You know, you're not going straight into a factory bike. I don't think Jorge Lorenzo would be any further back from where he is now. If that had been in place when he came up, you know, if he'd gone to Tech Tour, I think he'd have been blisteringly quick, but probably wouldn't have won as many races in his first year. But, you know, I don't think it was a bad thing at the time. But now, you know, we don't have that situation that we had then of superstars coming through, except for the odd one or two. And we don't have a bunch of spare satellite seats. As you said, Gresini's down to one bike in the prototype class.
Yep.
LCR have got a two-year contract at Bradle, so that one's the closed door anyway. And the one theory that I did hear that I thought had some credence before last weekend was that Marquez's entire team might move up, so he would be Kikeser. With obviously Repsol backing as well.
Right.
But then of course they'd have to relax the four bike rule, which will be discussed with Martin Rains later, so we won't go into that.
Yeah, the other thing is that you have to remember Danny Pedrosa was a little bit different than Marquez. Danny Pedrosa came into MotoGP and then got the Repsol sponsorship. Remember, he was sponsored by Movistar, and in fact, his move from 250s to MotoGP actually soured Movistar on the MotoGP effort, and they ended up withdrawing and using that as an excuse to withdraw, you know, or stating that was part of their excuse. So,
but it's a good point that Ray's making. I think we know Marquez will be an HRC Repsol rider next year, but I think what Ray says, they may not just be changing one rider, maybe two.
Oh yeah.
When Casey announced his retirement, I suspect the biggest smile was on Danny's face because he must have thought, well, that improves my chances of staying. But he may not be safe.
No. I think the most telling thing was when, help me out, the name of the HRC racing president. Nakamoto.
He's the vice president of HRC, but he's the guy that we hear most.
Yes,
he's
exactly. Yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. You know, when he was asked, a few years ago about Rossi, he was pretty much like, yeah, it's over, you know. And this time he's, you know.
What was the phrase? All things are possible.
Yes, exactly. All things are possible.
Which is almost exactly what Lynn Jarvis said as well.
Yeah. Which is, you know, which would be, I tried not to talk about this last week. We could be talking about for hours all the different permutations that are interesting and if there's the way this silly season is going to play out. But, I can totally see a Marquez Rossi team. Think about how great this is for Repsol, right? They get Rossi back. They could possibly win with him one last time, which would be for them a big coup because they could say, well, look, you know, he couldn't do it on the Ducati. He did it with us. It's a great story, right? For them, for him. At the same time, that he can be not necessarily a mentor to Marquez, but I mean, they have, it's what Yamaha did with Lorenzo, right? They brought in a young guy and they said, no matter what, we're going to keep Lorenzo.
Yeah, that didn't go so well for Valentino.
It didn't go so well for Valentino, but...
And the other thing is...
But Valentino still won a championship, you know, before it turned.
Oh, 8-9.
Exactly.
Yeah, but I do think the stumbling block is there can't be anyone Italian in HRC. They'll have to get rid of Livio Supo, because if there's no one Italian, Rossi can say, oh, no, the stuff I put in my book... That was lost in translation. If Livio Supo is still there, he can say, really? Because I've read the original in Italian and you are definitely very, very rude about HRC. You know, I mean, I don't know. It's
maybe,
a long
maybe,
time.
Maybe that, it's time. Maybe it's time for a new book before contracts get signed.
Yeah.
What if I hadn't written it?
What if I'd never written it?
Yeah.
I can't remember who it was on Twitter who said the name of the book, the new version should be I Wish I'd Never Tried It, referring to the Ducati.
Yeah.
Ray goes on and commenting on the TT0, he said, I'm surprised that Michael Sis described his bike as being potentially less beautiful than last year's. Watching the TT0 highlights, it looks stunning. I'm a designer, and my professional opinion is that it's at the leading edge of styling in motorcycles. I love the rear end, especially the aerodynamic aids, because it gave it the look of a late 80s bike, which is very fitting considering how in the 80s are in graphic design and music today. Moreover, if someone were to say that the Moto Sis was a GP bike from 2020 bought back in a time machine, I would believe them. Oh, what, are you trying to say that GP will be electric?
Maybe, but to me it looked more like a Flash Gordon type of 1920s Flash Gordon bike motorcycle than from the future. But you know, good opinion. I found it unbelievably ugly standing still and really beautiful with a rider on it moving. So you know, and hey, it won. Right, that's what matters.
Exactly. Yeah. Unfortunately for Mark Miller, it won with Michael Rutter on board.
I do have to say, I do have to commend the Moto Chish. I mean, Michael Chish has always been about the combination of form and function. He's always kept that designer, aesthetic design a very, very integral part of the motorcycle. So I think that's probably why he had that blog post saying, like, listen, get ready for this bike because it's going to be a little bit different looking. It might put some people off, you know.
It's definitely striking, but
it is.
But anything distinctive will always have people going, ugh. And other people going, wow.
Yeah.
You know, so, yeah, I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing.
Ducati Diavel, perfect example, right?
Yeah. And then Ray's other point was the bit about Tirol in Moto2 and what's happened to him. And he's basically saying Zarco's had some moments near the front and he's on a respectable 28 points. Obviously, he DNF'd at Silverstone. He said Tirol is on 3 points. What's happened? And as you pointed out in the notes, we have, you know, pay more attention, Ray. We've been talking about this. But it is interesting, particularly when you look at the fact that Tirol is on an Aspar and they've traditionally been one of the very successful teams in both 125 and 250 and then Moto2. And obviously, you know, they won with Tony Elias in the first year of Moto2. And you think, did they? No, sorry, Elias wasn't on Aspar.
No,
I'm talking Hoopla. He's on Aspar this year. But, you know, but they've been up front. They're used to being one of the leading teams and they're Tony's not doing very well, and Tyrrell's doing terribly. So, you know, it is interesting to look at that. And then he speculated a bit about Marquez, but it's to do with the rookie rule, which seems like it's been binned.
Yes. So I actually think that Tyrrell has already hit his peak. And he actually would do better in Moto3, and I would not be surprised if he stepped back to Moto3 for next year.
Now, how old is he, and what's the age? Mind you, he's not as old as you think, is he?
No, he's young.
He's only 23.
He's got years in Moto3.
Yeah.
Phil Bell is 28. He's going to get kicked out at the end of this year. They're going to be like, dude, you got to move up.
Yeah.
But you're old. Yeah, no, Tyrrell's got plenty of time.
Yeah. And then we had Gary Shavitt talking about the race, which, so if anyone isn't aware, then what are you doing listening to this show? he says, how is it they let Cal Crutchlow race on Sunday after having not even gone out during QP on Saturday? Isn't there some sort of rule about that? Or is it another Dorna rule number one, i.e. Dorna will decide which rules to enforce and which to ignore? It's not that, Gary. It's and we've actually responded to Gary by email, but the 107% rule is that during qualifying, to qualify for the grid, for the race, a rider must be able to achieve a time within 107% of the pole position time. Now, that is to ensure that if you get, you know, a wild card or an unknown rider at the first race of the season, they're not dangerously slow.
Right.
Now, Cal got injured on FP3 Saturday morning, was still in a queue to have a scan at one of our wonderful NHS hospitals Saturday afternoon. I saw Hervé and said, how's it going? And he swore a bit and said, how can it take 5 hours to get a scan? And I, that's the NHS for you. But on the plus side, it's free.
Right.
Anyway, so he didn't qualify. However, he had a number of lap times from earlier sessions that were within 107%. And it's also a case of if there's a regular rider in irregular circumstances, i.e. injured or destroys both bikes just before QP, then it can be waived. Sometimes if the previous sessions have been wet, he might not have achieved that 107%, but they can make the assessment that if he's fit to ride, he's safe to ride because we know the pace he can maintain. He also was looked at by both Clinica Mobilade team and Race Direction during warm-up just to make sure that he had the pace to be safe. So that's why it's not a question of ignoring the rule. Because bottom line is, if it happens to Lorenzo, Rossi, and Stoner, there's a bit of oil on the track, and they all crash and hurt themselves, but they're good enough to race. We can't have, the race being told, no, sorry, they haven't achieved
107%,
right, so they can't go out. It would just ruin the show.
Yep, yep. And boy, it would have ruined the show in this case.
Oh yeah, yeah.
We got this great email sent to us with a little video clip from Chris Rees. He made this great little TT film, I think completely with an iPhone. And we said, dude, you got to share this. So he ended up putting it on Vimeo, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes, because it really is a great little fan's perspective video. Oh, from the IOM.
Yeah.
So check
that
out.
I've only just signed up to Vimeo, and the reason I did was Charlie Hiscott, who is a friend of the show and TV producer. He was working for Silverstone TV last weekend, but more often than is found with Eurosport. Charlie's got his own little channel on there. And if anyone saw the look back at 2009 Catalunya, that amazing video with clips of pieces. Now, I don't think Charlie actually put that together, but that's on Charlie's channel. But he's done one, he's put one together with Stoner with some of that super slow-mo footage, and it is absolutely amazing. And there's some great little videos on there. So if you go to Vimeo and put Charlie Hiscott into
the
search, or
we'll put a link in the show notes.
Yeah, brilliant. We'll put a link in. Charlie's got some great little videos up there.
Cool.
And he wants as many people to see it as possible before he gets told to take it down, which happened before. and finally, this was brilliant. I played this on my iPhone and sat next to Andrew Wheeler in the media center. I played this and he went, what was that? That sounded like, go on, you explain.
Well, so Jim and I were just joking around last week during the show that we didn't know how to say shit in Spanish, and that most likely Len Padilla would tell us. And sure enough, Len Padilla sent us in an audio. So here's how it goes.
En castellano decimos mierda.
So for any Spanish listeners, we apologize for our language.
Yes.
For anyone else, if you want to learn how to speak Spanish and swear, there you go. Miscellaneous pre-show bits and news. We have now one thing. When I had the interview with Lucio Ceccanello, when the interview had finished, he was very keen to show me, and I do subscribe anyway, and hadn't really mentioned it. I wasn't trying to keep it to myself, but LCR do an online magazine, and it really is a fantastic little thing. Now, it's not just about LCR. It covers all sorts of racing. They've got, and he was showing me the forthcoming, the June edition. It's a monthly thing. Mm-hmm. And there's some brilliant articles in there. They've got Richard Branson talking about his interest in, you know, yes, as Virgin boss, we do look at MotoGP and we wonder if we can get involved. In May's, there's a brilliant interview with Stefan Bradl, who is obviously the LCR rider, and his dad, Helmut Bradl. And it's just really funny. It's a right little knockabout. But also, in the upcoming one, there is an article on Luca Cadalora. And I said to Lucio, well, are you not going to do a retrospective of your career? And he said, well, I said, well, you were a very successful racer on yourself. And he went, no. And he sort of smiled and went, no, I can't do this. I'm not comfortable. And I just thought, it is absolutely the measure of the man. He's not a self-promoter, even though he has to promote his team.
He's a very good promoter, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah, no, but absolutely, absolutely charming man. We'll put a link into the show notes. It's at www.inspire-lcr.com. Inspire as in inspire me.
Right. You might want to turn the volume down before you do that.
Yeah, there's music that runs, and I couldn't find the mute button for the music. So if you've got other audio running on your laptop, then you'll have a bit of a clash. So just turn it down. But it really is a very, very professionally put together little magazine. We also had a more successful listener meetup, but there were quite a lot of people turned up. And then we joined together with Scott Jones, who's a photographer for Moto Matters. And so there's quite a lot of people. I can remember very few names. We did meet up yet again with Steve Schmidt and his mate, I think it was Andrew, who was another brewer. Steve is the expat American living in London, who's had a really successful but therefore busy year brewing his beer. And it was great to see Steve again. And Val Wilkes, a really lovely lady, very knowledgeable. She came along with a bunch of friends, husbands, children. There was definitely an Andy in there somewhere. And we handed out lots of stickers. Jenny Elge turned up with her dad, I believe, and she's one of the girls you see on Twitter. Has some good opinions on racing, and so lots of stickers are out there. The MotoPod word is spreading.
Yay.
But unfortunately, we did have a planned round table. We thought we'd do a little fan forum with Guy Anderson, who couldn't make it because he was moving house. Dave Neal and Craig Robertson. Craig couldn't make it till a Sunday, and Sundays are never good for meeting up with people because you're just too busy with the races. And unfortunately, Dave and I didn't manage to hook up on the Saturday, but we'll try and plan it a bit better for next year.
All right.
And news. Yeah, Crutchlow to Ducati. Apparently they're interested.
Yeah. So this is Matt Burt I guess he dropped a bomb in typical MCN style, but
it's a possibility, but in the words of Nakamoto-san, anything is possible.
Yes, thank and you very
there's
much.
Far too much or the, not far too much there's lots and lots and lots of speculation out on Twitter, on the fan forums, on our Facebook page. We really could put together a multi hour show. In fact, we could probably make the show last as long as silly season if we were to talk about all the possible permutations. So let's wait and see what happens. Lorenzo signed. That's the key piece is now in place. The next key piece will be Rossi, and then the rest will fall into place. But interestingly, the last bit is this story is broken that HRC are planning to produce production racing MotoGP bikes,
right,
which would meet CRT criteria in letter, if not in spirit. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
They want to win both championships.
They certainly do. Right, we have got some interviews to run. Yeah. We're going to start with Lucio Ceccanello. This was an interview I did on Friday morning. Great thanks to Elisa, Elisa Pavan, his PR lady, the press officer for LCR, for getting us this. And Lucio was absolutely charming. Fascinating interview. Very, very honest and open. So here we go. Hello, this is Martin for MotoPod, and I'm with Lucio Ceccanello, the team principal of LCR Honda MotoGP team. Lucio, welcome to the show. We're here on Friday at Silverstone. It's been another wet, dry session. But more generally, the season so far is looking absolutely fantastic with Stefan Bradl on your bike.
Thank you very much. Absolutely fantastic is a big compliment and big word, but let's say that we are very happy with the results of Stefan, with his performances, because in fact, as everybody knows, Stefan is a debutant, so considering his limited experience he has in the MotoGP class, already being so fast, very, very near to the more experienced guys like Bautista, like Dovizioso, like Ben Spies, like Niki, and sometimes beat them, it's really fantastic.
I mean, certainly I think everyone saw last year that Stefan's a very clever racer. He can use his brain as well as his skill. What stage last year did you start thinking this is someone I want to bring into the team?
Yeah, I want to be honest. Last year we tried, to convince Andrea Dovizioso to stay in Honda and to join our team. That's why we consider Stefan as a in suborder after having done everything to convince Andrea Dovizioso to stay with Honda. When after the Grand Prix of Japan, Andrea Dovizioso took his decision to leave Honda and to go to Yamaha Tech 3, we started to look at another rider. We had some option, or either to continue to work back with Randy Depugnier,
yeah,
or to bet and take another young rider. The decision was very, very difficult, very tough for us, because especially after a very difficult season like we had in 2011,
yeah,
for us, you know, we couldn't make any extra mistake, you know, in rider sure. choice, and for some reason we couldn't do good results in 2011, so for us I'd be a little bit scared, you know, to bet
sure.
in a young rider. I must say that Mr. Nakamoto from HRC, the HRC vice president, support and push me to take the risk, you
yeah.
know, and we decide to go ahead with a young promise, and definitely when he won the title in Valencia, we being still under
undecided
yeah. and we give to him one possibility to test our bike in Valencia after the race, and he definitely perform immediately, and
yeah.
then we decide, okay, that's the guy and let's go on.
It's fantastic to see, because you'd had such a good year with Randy Depugnier in 2010 till the injury. And I think a lot of people thought you seemed to suit each other. Randy was happy here, you know, he got really good results, and I think a lot of people felt he would come back. But from a fan's perspective looking in, I'd say your gamble was paid. It's looking good.
At the moment we are very satisfied with Stefan. Also, as you said, it's a very clever guy, and this is fantastic because not only because he is doing always, you know, a very good job with us on track and off track, but also because we like the way how he is as a man, as a person, you know, and that's very important for us, because when you respect a rider for what he is able to do on track, and you respect a rider as a person, what he is able to do, you know, in all small things, including, you know, give a smile to a fan, or to stop to have a pitch, to take a picture with them, or to give an autograph, or you know, to be normal as many fans like to see their hero as well.
Yeah, I was speaking to your press officer Elisa earlier, and she was saying that she almost found it a surprise that he's so popular in Britain, and we were saying you can't generalise and say, you know, British like that and Americans like that and Italians like that, but I think generally most racing fans, they like their hero racers to be nice guys.
Yeah.
And he interviews so well. You know, he's never been arrogant. He always comes across as if he's got appreciation for everything else that put him on that seat.
Yeah.
And yet, when he goes out there, he's been fast.
Yeah.
You know, and you can hear it in the commentary. There's that almost surprise and thinking, okay, maybe Qatar suited him. And then we go to Jerez, and okay, Jerez suits him as well. And he really seems to have found a home here. So it's great to see. One of the other aspects of LCR, which I think people look at and are fascinated by, is you have a tendency to, or an ability to get short-term sponsorship from different race to different race, and we'll see a special bike come out for one race. I mean, everyone laughed, I think, when we had Randy in the year with the Playboy sponsorship, but in some countries that wasn't seen as appropriate, so we had different sponsorship, and Randy de Pugnet, with my wife, her second favourite rider after Valentino Rossi is Randy de Pugnet, because he used to crash a lot and take his leathers off. Yeah, it happens. But, you know, where did this come from, this idea about going to do specials for different races? Is it something you've always done, or...?
Well, you know, when you are, let's say, in difficulties... difficulties push everybody to, you know, to react and to invent something, you know, to face the problems, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't want to, you know, to I mean, I have to be honest, the reality is that the sponsorship market after end of 2008 we have got a big problem, you know, because all the sponsorship market dropped down, and the company turnover, all the company's turnover is down, and now, you know, all the advertising expenses are very selected and very limited. So when we think that we have to pay huge expenses to run our team, we needed to go to try to invent another approach, because the idea was quite simple, you know, because looking at what Dorna is doing when they organize their Grand Prix, they have different Grand Prix title sponsor, you know.
Yeah.
And then I thought, why we can't do the same with the bike?
Yeah.
And this is something that maybe will oblige us to have more work, you know, in terms of decoration, in terms of painting, in terms of you know, many other items we have to prepare. because we have to personalize, you know, from the bike up to the hospitality, the scooter, the website, everything. Yeah. But at least let's say that you can you have more chance to persuade a sponsor, you know, to come on board of your project if you are able to show a big visibility specifically in the market where they wish to be,
to operate,
and yeah, to operate, you know. So yeah. Also, in, you know, if we consider, for example, that if just we suppose that to be a title sponsor of a MotoGP team, we the sponsor need to pay hundreds. In turn, to ask the sponsor hundreds, you just ask 1/18th of hundreds, you know, because yeah, it's just one Grand Prix, and instead of 18th Grand Prix, so the amount is drastically reduced, and then let's say you can select, for example, with GV or with Elf or whatever. Now we select the countries
that they wish to,
they wish
have that profile,
the boost, yeah, of the visibility.
Yeah.
Basically, the sponsors who are getting the title sponsor space are already sponsors that are on board of our project, are permanent sponsor for the full season sponsor, like Alpha, for example, or like Linear, or like, yeah, GV. They appear in our bikes and so on, or in our clothing and so on. Then they just have a boost of visibility in the market, specific market where,
sure,
they wish to have better visibility.
Well, it certainly seems to be working. And leading off now, and Stefan's on a 2-year contract, I believe.
Correct.
So this year and next year, yeah, which must have seemed like more of a gamble, but at least with everything happening with Casey retiring, I mean, Jorge's now signed for Yamaha for the next 2 years, so that means things can start to happen. But is it a relief not to be involved in silly season this year? That you know what you have next year? Does it make it easier?
Yeah. For our point of view, I mean, of course, you know, we, before to sign a 2-year contract, we had a deep consideration, deep thinking, you know. But after having seen him performing so well immediately when he jumped on the bike for the first time, and we been discussing with Honda seriously, and also with our sponsor, and we said, okay, let's take the risk. Honda is behind because if something happened,
yeah,
Honda can continue to support us anyway, but for us is also very important to, if we have a debutant, to have at least 2 years project, you know, because no meaning, yeah, you know, to change a rider every year, you know, especially, you know, when you are doing a such difficult job like participating in the MotoGP class, it's very important, for example, to have the same group of people working together, because I believe very much in the continuity of
yeah,
some program. You know, if you are going continue to change technicians, mechanics, riders, and so on, you never build up something.
Yeah,
you know, it takes time sometimes, but. Mm. You need to capitalize in previous experience.
I think there's some football teams could use that advice, who change their manager 3 times a year in England and in Italy.
Sometimes, yeah, it's. I believe that it's better to, you know, before to hectic panic. You know, it's,
yeah,
much better to say, oh, let's say, stay like this and try to focus and step by step build up, you know, and adjust the mistakes and so,
yeah,
on, and try to work hard with the rider. Also, you know, it's very important in MotoGP, the communication between the rider and the chief technicians.
Yeah.
Because also you have the crew chief, you have the data recording responsible, you have the on the engineer, you know, have the suspension advisor. So it's very important, you know, to tune. You know, it's very important that the rider is able to
describe
what he's feeling and so on, and it's a communication process that takes time, so, you know, very very quick. That's why many riders prefer to keep their engineer also in other teams' projects, because it's very important the way how they establish a communication, you know.
Sure.
That's why we believe that we said, okay, let's do a 2 years project, and then one less problem, you know.
Yeah. And very finally, Lucio, the future for MotoGP and for LCR, we have CRT now. Do you see LCR remaining with a satellite Honda bike for the foreseeable future, or have you thought about CRT, or which direction would you like to take your team in?
Well, since we are in MotoGP class, we are riding with one rider only in MotoGP class. Let's say that my dream would be to complete this project and to be able to have two rider team. The problem is that already having one rider team, it's very very expensive.
Yeah.
And let's say that my dream will be to have two factory satellite bikes, like, for example, the team Poncheral has with Yamaha, you know, and then being able to have a two-rider team and working together with Honda with their factory bikes, as now. I'm not... I don't want to say that the CRT is not interesting as a class, as a category, because for sure is very... could be very interesting and very challenging, you know, to build up a bike, you know, and to have much more possibility to work on a bike compared to what we are doing now, especially because my background is a technical background. Also, I've been a mechanic when I was a kid, you know, and I would love to see an LCR bike, you know, with an Honda engine, you know.
Yeah,
I would really would love. But it's something that I would like to do when first we will have the sponsor interested to support that project. And so far, our sponsors are more interested in support our project with a factory bike. And second, when the CRT machine will be more competitive, more nearby the extraordinary factory bike they have now. So let's say that it's something that we have on mind, to have to ride the team, but maybe not now.
Okay. Lucio Ciacinello, thank you very much indeed for your time, and best of luck for the weekend.
Thank you very much. Also, thank to give me the chance to have this interview, and I hope that your fan and everybody can continue to watch us and to support us as they did in the past in a great way.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you. And fantastic. Really, really enjoyed that. And I found this with all the guys I interviewed. You then, when you see them around the paddock, they're like, oh, hi, you know, and chat away. I was interested in the admission that LCR chased Andrea Dovizioso. And for the cynics out there who were saying, well, LCR don't pick their riders, they're told who to employ, I'd give a resounding oh, shit to that. Nice. And say, no, they he very clearly, of course, there is, you know, Honda support is necessary, mm-hmm. but I just liked his, you know, his admission that we took a great gamble, but also the input he really stressed, and his expression reinforced his tone, that the one of the big things with Stefan Bradl was that they liked him as a man.
Yeah. That was such a cool thing to say.
Actually, because, you know, we've all seen, you know, the arrogant rider.
Mm-hmm.
And it would imply that unless you have such blistering talent that you can get away with it, it actually can harm your employment prospects. And you notice not once...
Biaggi. Sorry.
Sorry. Yeah. Oh, you're so getting blocked on Twitter from by him. Sorry, that's a bit arrogant to presume he'd actually listen to us. You know, I like you, Max, just in case. No, I don't. Sorry. Anyway, at no stage did we mention, did anyone mention the name Tony Elias, but there was the, we just couldn't afford another year like 2010.
11.
And I loved his race analogy. You know, the races are sponsored by from country to country to country. And I almost got the feeling that's where Lucio got the idea for this incredibly rare form of sponsorship he does, where they do these specials. But, you know...
It's a lot of work. And I think if we do a follow-up with him, we should ask him just how the hell does he do it? Is it really just him, you know? Does he have a crew of interns? I mean, they don't have the money to pay a marketing firm to go find sponsorship. You know, I think it's really kidding.
Having met him, I think he has the cachet with his name and his background and the fact that he's boss. But he also, there is a very, very understated charisma. He would be a very difficult person to say no to because you'd never get the feeling that he was demanding anything.
Right.
It would always be.
You'd feel bad.
Yeah. No, you would. Absolutely. It's incredibly effective.
Yeah.
And that was really good. I went from Lucio I don't know. It was funny. I came away from the weekend with very much a feeling of investing emotion in LCR and Tectoire. Tectoire I have already in the past. LCR, I certainly did when Randy De Puglia was riding for them, and it pained me to see the struggles they had, Antonio Elias had last year. But we've spoken to Lucio before. He's always come across as a really nice guy. And I was thinking, we are the podcast equivalent of LCR and Tectoire. We don't have the budget or the punch of the big teams, but we can sometimes get amongst them and mix it up a bit, you know.
Right on, dude. I like that.
So I like it. Yeah, it's probably another display of my burgeoning arrogance, seeing as I, you know, I've had my weekend pretending to be a journalist. But I then went and spoke to Hervé. And again, great thanks to Milena Kerner, who's the press officer for Tectoire. She was brilliant all weekend. And these press officers, they tirelessly go out their way to really help you. There were one or two exceptions, but we didn't get anywhere with those, so they're not going to get mentioned. But Milena was brilliant. And Hervé, as you're about to hear, is just as open and engaging as Lucio.
And the energy.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Hello, this is Martin for MotorPod with Hervé Poncharal, the team principal of Tectoire Monster Yamaha MotoGP team and president of IRTA, the Race Team Association. It's Friday afternoon. We've had tricky conditions today. But more generally, over the season so far, Hervé, you've got two riders, fourth and fifth in the championship. Their worst results has been 7th and 8th at Le Mans when they both crashed and remounted. In those terms, fantastic season. But from a human point of view, as a team manager, how difficult is it to watch your two riders wheel to wheel racing each other, which we've seen quite a lot?
It is very difficult. It is very difficult, especially for me. You know, I'm somebody who is I'm a worried man more than some other guys. And to see them almost every single lap of every single race so far, so close to each other, and I know they want bitterly to beat each other, although the team atmosphere and in between them is incredibly good. But you know, when they're on track, they are rivals. So I know that a lot of times this is very hot. The passing is extremely close, and you know, the disaster is always quite close. You know, it's never very far. So far, they managed to be very aggressive. They managed to be, you know, really close to each other without doing any mistake. They were never unhappy with each other after the race, because sometimes, you know, they could say, "Ah, he held me," or "He didn't do it too clean the pass," but it never happened. So during the race, this is a tough time for me. I always expect one of them is going to make a slight mistake for, you know, a bigger gap between the two, but it rarely happened. And no, that's hard to live for 50 minutes, but you know, we have a much longer time until the next race where we will worry to enjoy the good result we are at so far, because as you said, apart from Le Mans, where they finished 7th and 8th after crashing and remounting on their bike, we've been having the worst result 4th and 5th.
Yeah.
So, no, this is, for me, this is the best season so far we have had in MotoGP class. This is the strongest lineup we ever had with Cal and Andrea. Also, I want to say that all this is only possible because of the incredible performance support we got from Yamaha.
Yeah.
So far tonight, I'm a happy man.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah, I mean, certainly, it's interesting as a fan watching. They have very different styles,
Andrea
and Cal, but it seems to get them around the circuit. They're very, very close together.
Exactly. You know, Cal and Andrea have got a completely different personality, which is also giving a completely different riding style, but very different riding style, very different setting of the bike, sometimes opposite direction to set up the bike, and incredibly close lap time, because sometimes we are separating between, you know, it's only thousands of seconds.
Yeah.
So your point is very interesting, and you know, complete different method, but arriving at the same level. And yeah, I didn't expect that at the start of the season, because when we were during the winter test, they were having so different methods, so different riding style. We said that I thought in the race there will be bigger gap in between them. You know,
yeah, you'd imagine that one style would suit one type of circuit, yeah, one condition, yeah, yeah, a lot, yeah, more than the other.
But so far, it doesn't matter if it's any track, any weather condition, they are together,
yeah,
almost identical lap time, identical performance. So this is, you know, and even in Barcelona, where Andrea got his first podium, at some stage we thought, oh, okay, Cal is losing a bit. But at the end of the race, they were, you know, separated by something like less than 2 seconds.
Yeah.
So every race they've been almost together.
And being fourth and fifth in the championship means they are splitting the,
yes,
factory bikes.
Yes.
There are three factory riders behind them.
Yes. Yes. And you know, the factory team, which is supposed to get the best spec, and you know, which is supposed to have the best riders. Lorenzo, of course, is leading the championship, so it's in front of us. But our two riders have been so far at each race finishing in front of Ben, who is the second factory rider. So this is clearly showing their level.
Yeah. And in the past, it's always felt, we've always felt, that the satellite bikes start very close to the factory bikes. And then as the season progresses, the factory bikes get the improvements quicker. With the new 1000cc, is this happening slower this year? Or
I think, honestly, okay, there are a lot of analyses from the outside world, the media, the fans, and even some riders. But the truth is, this year, the main difference is the quality of our riders.
Yeah.
Because I remember 2010, for example, with Ben, the start of the season for his rookie season with us was a bit, Ben Spies, was a bit, was good, but he was 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, something like that. And then halfway through the season, he really started to be strong. He got his first podium in Silverstone, he got a pole in Indy, he's been leading the race in Indy for 7 laps. He ended up second, only behind Dani Pedrosa, so it means he was in front of the Yamaha factory guy. So you cannot say as the season goes, the performance were going down. You know?
No.
So clearly, I believe Yamaha's support has always been incredibly good and performant. doesn't matter if it was in 11 with 800cc or 12 with 1000cc. I think this is not the right explanation. The right explanation is Cal and Andrea this year are the best rider we had for many, many years.
Yeah.
And they are making the difference. And for sure, because of the result, a lot of people are trying to say, how come? How can we explain? And some people said, okay, the fact that we switched to 1000, we are year one, we are closer to the spec of the factory bike. But we've always been close, very yeah. close. And the example I gave you about Ben in 2010 shows that we always got, you know, top level support.
Yeah, no, thanks for that. That's interesting to hear. Thinking about, we've got CRTs now.
Yes.
Now, last year, we know that your team looked at the possibility, and you had Guy Coulon,
who's yes.
generally seen as one of the most genius engineers out there, and designers. What was it persuaded you not to go down that route?
You know, clearly, I think I've been working on the CRT rule with everybody, and I think this is a good rule at the moment. This is under a lot of critique, but every time you're doing something, you're changing something. If you change nothing, you're under critic. If you change something, you're under critic. So I'm fine with this. You know, Moto2 was criticized a lot, and now this is a fun tactics class.
Yeah.
I think Moto3 is bringing much more excitement than 1-5, and it was also under a lot of critic. CRT, I want to say, at the moment, brought this year 9 riders on the grid. These riders would have not been MotoGP riders, they are MotoGP riders. Without the CRT, we would have 12 bikes on the grid. Do we want a championship with 12 bikes on the grid? No.
No.
We'll have looked ridiculous. So only for that, first point, CRT helped the championship. There is a gap in between the two classes for sure. Not huge gap, because we have less gap in between first and last in our championship with CRT than in Formula 1 and even than Superbike, which is... So
yeah.
When you look at the lap time of the pole setter in Superbike and the last one, very often there is more gap than what we have in between the top guy in MotoGP and the last CRT. So clearly this is not dangerous. They are mixing with some non-CRT bike, what we can call factory prototype. And this is clearly the future, because we all know we're going through a very tough time. Economically speaking, everything is difficult. The manufacturers, motorcycle manufacturers, are also struggling, like everybody. So therefore, the money involved here is going to be less and less and less. And you need to survive. So we need to be in connection with the real world. We cannot have prototype that costs millions, and otherwise we are going to end up with 2 bikes on the grid.
Yeah.
Because if we have less bike on the grid, it's because less and less people can afford. So we got to find something to that brings a good show. Good battle means equal performance, and you know, keep all the team manager happy enough to continue, you know, like the situation we have now in Moto2 and Moto3. Having said that, I wanted to go, and ultimately I will do something in CRT. But because of the rule is not completely fixed, because we know ideally 15, but maybe 14, we will have a rule where we will not have any more the difference we have now. And having a 2-year contract with Yamaha, you know, I thought, I don't want to do too much. Already have my Moto2, Moto3, I will wait a bit. What's the point to spend a lot of money on a CRT project where nobody's following me? I've got the 2M1 with top guys like Cal Crutchlow and Dovizioso. So sometimes you don't want to spread too much your effort.
Yeah.
And I said, better concentrate. So although I've been thinking, after thinking a bit more and calculating, I thought, better wait.
Yeah.
Look well after Cal and Andrea, and do the MotoGP, you know, Yamaha program as good as I can, which is what we're doing, and I'm not regretting at all.
Yeah.
And wait to see where the CRT's rule are going to go, and when they will be fixed, we will see.
With a view to cutting costs, keeping things affordable, maximising the bikes on the grid, as IRTA president, you probably like the idea of a one bike rule, which is being mooted for next year.
So,
as a team manager, is it good or is it?
It's a good point also that you raise. You know, I've been thinking a lot. I think there are two ways to see the thing. First, I think MotoGP is the pinnacle, you said?
Yeah.
Motorcycle racing. So clearly we don't want to be looking exactly like a Superbike national championship, because otherwise what is the point? We need to have something that makes people dream, and that is the ultimate step of in motorcycle racing, like Formula One is in car racing.
So
on the other hand, we need to think about cost a lot, and this is priority. We've been calculating a lot, and if you think one bike per rider is half cost of two bikes, is completely wrong. Because if you have a one bike rule, you need to have a rolling chassis ready to go if you have a crash in a practice for the next practice.
Yeah.
And an engine and everything. So we calculated on spare parts, it's more or less the same. The only difference is one is assembled, the other one is waiting in the truck to be assembled. But that will hurt the show. Because if somebody crash on the outlap of a qualifying, already we don't have so many bikes on the grid, this is one less, guy on the grid, and this is hurting the show, and this could create big problem for the championship, because if you crash and you can bring, because with a car sometimes you just spin and you can bring the car back. With a bike, if it goes like this, forget about it, you can't repair, so you miss the whole session. If it's qualifying, it's a big problem and you can lose the championship. Point one, we thought maybe you can save some stuff, but if you destroy a bike and you have to rebuild the whole bike for the next practice, you need to have a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
So you can say, I'm going to have less stuff for one bike rule than two bike rule. The freight, as I said before, you carry the same almost, because you need to bring the parts in case you crash your bike. You do the same mileage. So I've been calculating a lot, and the saving, there is some saving, but between you and me, this is peanuts. Yeah. Peanuts. This is very small saving. And to come back to the image, everybody else is on a one bike rule. Moto 2, Moto 3, Superbike, Super Sport. We need to be different.
Yeah.
So if we are the only class that can afford and that can keep the two bikes, this is better for the show. I need sponsor in MotoGP class. When they go to the garage, they see the two bikes, the rider going, we need to show them that they are invested, because we are asking more money to have to be MotoGP sponsor than Moto2 or Superbike. So we need to give them more.
Yeah.
And when you calculate the two, I think there is more to gain to keep the Moto2, the two bike rule, than going to the one bike rule. And sometimes it's not easy for some people who make a simple calculation. One bike, two bike, divided by two. It's not working like that.
And of course, during a race, if you have a wet to dry, that causes problems.
Yes.
Do we do aggregate time?
No. We don't want. No, we can't go that, because we need to go to keep the flag to flag race. Because especially for the TV format and even for the spectator, they understand nothing. I remember sometime in Aspen we had three starts, and we almost ended up in the night.
Yeah.
The people with aggregate, they understand nothing.
Yeah.
And I think it is a lack of respect for everybody.
Sure.
To keep them waiting and don't know what's happening. And now we start the race and we go till the end. Doesn't matter if it's raining, if it's dry, if it's sunny, we go.
Yeah.
And I think this is very important to keep that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think.
So, altogether, we should keep the two bike rule.
Good, thank you. Another aspect is there's lots of talk that Brandy Smith, who's riding the Mistral chassis, the Tectoire Moto2 bike, has a contract to join the MotoGP team next year.
At the moment, I think a lot of things are possible. A lot of scenarios are possible. As I told you before, I've got an extremely strong lineup this year with Callum and Blair, which is the strongest and the best I had. So Bradley has a lot of potential, a lot. He's learning. This year he understands that this is not very easy, although today he was really good.
Yeah.
And that makes me so happy. So it's a bit early,
Remember last year where he came from the back
so
to second place.
It's a bit early to understand what's going to happen, and I think also my position, my duty is to... Merci. And you have always, doesn't matter what the contracts are saying, you have to have the right person at the right position at the right time, And this is all, together that we will make the decision that what is going to be the lineup for 13. But I think it will take still quite a few weeks.
So nothing set in stone?
No.
Yeah.
Nothing.
Okay.
Nothing.
finally, I don't want to keep any longer, but as your role of president of IRTA, is it correct you sit on the race direction board?
No.
I was just wondering if...
Not at all, because... and I'm happy with that. No, you got one Dorna guy, one rider representative, one FIM, and that's it. But I'm not at all...
You have nothing to do with that.
Because of the
Marquez incident, yeah, it was unusual for seeing the decision overturned. Although, I think
there are a lot of politics.
Yeah,
clearly the fact that the two guys are Spanish also played a big role. The fact that Marquez has been riding in the past, sometimes a bit aggressive, and that some people don't want to give the world the feeling that this guy can do anything he wants and he will never have any penalty. Play the game, but for me, honestly, if I look at what happened in the race, and this is shared by almost every rider who's been asked, this is a racing incident.
That was our favorite.
This is a racing incident because, you know, Marquez almost lost it, almost crashed.
That was an incredible save.
Yeah. He saved it, but of course, by saving it, he went on the outside and he came back, but he couldn't see Espargaró, who was behind him. Espargaró never thought Marquez... I don't know. For me, it's 50-50. I don't want to enter in any kind of polemic, but we have also something to keep in mind. We don't want to play with safety, but also, on the other hand, we want our sport to be exciting, and the main excitement in motorsport and in motorcycle racing is passing.
Yeah.
And we need aggressivity. Aggressivity which is not creating danger. But yeah, if you only follow... It's got to be a train, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, what made Valentino and Marquez and all these kind of guys famous, it's because they're arriving, they attack and they pass. Yeah. You know, I had a rider in the past that was world champion, Olivier Jacques. I don't know if you remember.
Yeah, I remember Olivier.
When he started, he was famous for his Jack attack, and he was called Jack attack. So you need to have, you know, and it's always a fine line in between, don't do too much because you're dangerous.
Yeah.
But, you know, you're a rider. Especially when you're 19, you're a kid, and you're here to race, you're here to push. Yeah. And I think this is what we like. What is dangerous, what is not dangerous, you can open the discussion now and it won't be over by 10 days.
And it's a nice way to round out, actually, thinking back to the days of Olivier Jacques and Sylvain Guintoli on Dunlops when they were kind of getting left behind, and now you look where you've brought your team to. It's been a heck of a season so far. Long may it continue. Hervé, thank you very much indeed for taking the time.
Thank you for your interest.
And no, not at all.
Thank you for your interesting question.
Oh, thank you. And good night. Thank you. So, I mean, Hervé.
I thought the really interesting thing that he said, there's something that I haven't seen anybody actually look at. So now I'm going to have to go. I didn't have a chance to do this yet, but about the fact that the difference in times between the top bike and the last bike, the lap times, I mean, are with regard to CRTs is smaller than F1 and superbikes. I have to look at the superbike stats.
Yeah, and this is also mentioned in the interview with Martin Raines, who
I know.
We talk about lies, damn lies, and statistics. When you're talking percentages, I think that can be true. But as I've been a fan of in the past, and we've done on the podcast, sometimes a statistic will highlight or will bring forth a truth that was otherwise hidden under propaganda bullshit.
Right.
You know, and this is something that there's so many people who are so determined to be down on CRT that, you know, sometimes you have to say to them, well, you know, the golden age of racing never happened.
Yeah.
If anything, we're in it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. There's memories become clouded with nostalgia, like you mentioned to Hervé.
Absolutely. Yeah. The interesting thing as well was I did like Hervé's thing of, you know, I'm a worried man more than other guys. I'm thinking you're in the wrong job if you're
that's exactly what I was thinking when he said that too.
And also the point that I think really needs to be made about the M1, when you look at the incredibly different styles of Dovi and Cal and Ben and
Jorge, although Dovi and Jorge, I think, as we'll hear later with Dovi, you know, that they're more similar. But Yamaha produced a bike that suits all these different styles, you know, so...
And we've talked about this before. It's because, and it was one of the things that I think stifled some riders in the past was, or stymied them, was that they've always been an incredible amount of things you can adjust on the frame.
Yeah, there's almost
the
too
chassis.
Much. You can overcomplicate.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so you could get lost, but it also allows this tremendous variety that now is making Yamaha blossom as all these different riders are starting to figure out. Because, you know, the thing is the formulas are there. So like, oh, you want to ride it this way? Let's start with this base setting. You want to ride it this way? Let's try it with the, you know, let's try the Rossi setting. Let's try the Lorenzo setting. Let's try the Spies setting. You know, it's like the Colin Edwards one. They've got this long history since the 990 era now that they can look back on as the start.
And now we're going to go with
little Colin Edwards.
Absolutely. We are with Texas Tornado. It's quite short on this, but he's as ever, he's on form and worth it. So take it away, Texas Tornado. It's Martin with MotoPod, and I'm here with Colin Edwards, Texas Tornado, with NGM Ford Racing Team. Tough season so far. How's the collarbone mending?
No, season's been fantastic. What are you talking about? Collarbone's good. Yeah, no problem. It's healed up. Still a little tender to touch, but on the bike, I don't even notice it. It's fine.
Yeah, I mean, obviously last year you got that incredible podium a week after having broken your collarbone at Catalunya, so
yeah.
I think you're known as a reasonably quick healer.
Yeah, not as young as I used to be, but it's amazing what a plate and some screws will do.
Yeah.
Heal
you
up pretty quick.
And some painkillers. Are you on stage again tonight?
No, not that I know of. I was on stage Thursday. Yeah, but I wasn't near as drunk as last year.
No, that was good.
It was a good
very
season.
Entertaining. I mean, on the season generally, we're a weekly podcast, as you know, so with the immediacy of how practice went today isn't as valid for us, but generally, how are you enjoying the CRT project, starting really from scratch with the Suda BMW? And
yeah, man, I'm not going to lie to you, it's a lot of work. You know, I knew coming over here it was going to be a lot of work, but at the same time, I mean, I find some kind of, I don't know, psychotic pleasure out of, you know, turning something, you know, that's obviously new into something rideable. We've come a long way through the year. We're still working, you know, and at the end of the day, you only have what you have to work with, so you got to try and finagle and massage it best you can to squeak out those last few tenths.
Yeah, and like you say, taking something raw and making it, and effectively you guys, all the CRT teams seem to be pretty much testing as you're racing.
I said, after the tests this year, they said, all right, let's go race. And I was like, screw that, I got 18 more tests left to do. You know, I mean, we don't know anything about gearbox going to these places. Setting, it's all testing.
And has the changeable weather that we've experienced just about in every round, it seems, has that been a real problem?
It's been a pain in the dick, yeah. It's, obviously when you go testing or when you got something like this, I think everybody out here would prefer to have nice dry conditions, for 18 races all 3 days. It just doesn't work out that way, and especially this year, it seems like it doesn't matter where we've gone, what we've done, it's been wet, dry, and of course, at the present time, we happen to be in Silverstone, so why would it be any different?
Yeah. Britain, yes. Yeah, welcome to our summer. Is there a particular round you're looking forward to, having ridden the bike and found its characteristics? Is the one you're thinking, that's where we can really do some good?
I don't know. I think we thought some tracks, some slower tracks, be it Sachsenring or even fast flowing tracks like maybe NASA. But as far as competing with the factory boys, yeah, that's that's a pipe dream at the moment. I mean, we got a lot of work to do to even. Yeah, I think we're averaging what, probably around three and a half seconds. You know, top CRT bike to pole. So 3 seconds is a lot. It's a lot.
Yeah, but I was speaking to Hervé Poncherolle yesterday. Obviously, you know very well, and he said that the gap between the front and the back in MotoGP is less than in Formula One or World Superbikes. So I think he's found himself quite encouraged by how close you guys have been.
Yeah, it. I mean, we don't have that, you know, the Grand Prix guys don't have that 2 second spread out like it used to be. Everybody's within normally 8, 9 tenths. It's crazy. Just work. It's just work. You know, we just got to put a dose of grindstone and get to work.
Well, it's nice to see you still smiling. I won't take any more of your time. Thanks very much indeed, right, Colin. So, Colin, his opening line, what the hell are you talking about? Been a fantastic season. It's like, okay, good, Colin's on form. But, I mean, I got to say, he looked tired. He looked not tired like he needs some sleep. He looked tired like, ooh. And as he said, a psychotic desire to, he's got a work ethic. You know, I remember hearing an interview with him years ago when some, I can't remember which ride it was, had just had a kid, and he's saying, good, that might slow them down. And the interviewer said, yeah, it's surely the wisdom is each child adds a second to your lap time. And Colin said, no, with me, it took a second off. I thought, damn, I've got to earn some money now. I've got kids to pay for. he's Colin. Absolutely brilliant. And I do think he's another one. He and Randy DiPugno in particular, bringing some credibility to the CRT project,
very much
to the CRT effort, and also huge amount of development experience. And the last one we'll do pre-race. And this was fascinating. Dr. Martin Rains at MotoGP Mart. And he's allowed to keep MotoGP, as Julian Ryder is, because, of course, they're employed by Dorna. They write the end of season review, or the annual, each year. And Martin Rains is the statistician for Dorna and MotoGP. He's passionate about the sport.
Very much so.
But he doesn't allow that passion to cloud his objectivity. He is as close as a MotoGP scientist as you're going to get. Well, he is a MotoGP scientist, but he's not. But he also has a feeling for the feel of it, the passion of it, the excitement, the unquantifiable elements that make it what it is. So, anyway, without further ado, it's about 15 minutes with Dr. Martin Rains. Here we are at Silverstone. It's Sunday morning, race morning. We've just had all three warm-up laps. This is Martin for MotorPod, and I'm with Dr. Martin Rains, the official MotoGP statistician, at MotoGP Mart is his Twitter address, and many of you will have enjoyed the trivia questions that Martin likes to put out. Good morning, Martin.
Good morning. It's great to be here. It's nice and sunny as well, isn't it, for once?
Yeah, there's a bit of cloud building up. There's less wind than yesterday, which is great. We just had a reasonably interesting warm-up session from all three classes. The Vuvuzela Moto3s have just come in, and we're overlooking the start-finish straight. The grandstands are filling up. It's looking good.
Perhaps when I say it's sunny, that's a little optimistic. At least it's dry.
Yeah, and we have seen the sun. Yes. So that's certainly a good start. We've been having various chats over the weekend. What I really like to examine your thoughts on is a kind of state of the nation. We've got CRT the first year, or the first season we've had it. We've got Moto3, which I think most people are agreeing has been a huge success. Jim Race particularly will be very upset at the loss of the two-strokes, but I'm sure he's got a little two-stroke engine in his garden and go and sniff every now and again for nostalgia purposes. So what are your feelings about what the necessity that brought us to this decision with CRT, but also how it's doing and where it's likely to lead?
I think it really, we're in the CRT position. It's probably from decisions that were taken more than 10 years ago with the introduction of MotoGP. The economies were booming then, the factories wanted to get involved, and probably nobody saw what was eventually going to come in terms of the economy, which has caused the situation we're in now. And the race organisers, the event organisers, Dawn and that, were not the only ones not to spot that coming. So when I think when the decision was made was to introduce MotoGP, it was done with the best of intentions to make it an almost exclusive all factory or factory come satellite class. And with the factories we had involved then, Yamaha, Honda, Suzuki, Kawasaki, Aprilia, things were looking good. And I think in the years up to 2006, we did all right, don't you? You agree?
Absolutely, yeah.
We had some great racing. We had Valentino Rossi. And then there was the move to 800, which is perhaps one decision that was not the best, but again, it's great for us having hindsight to see that. But we still have some good racing. Until we come to recent past few years with the economy turning down, and then we had Kawasaki withdrawing, Aprilia have already gone, we've had Suzuki down to one bike. So we ended up in a position last year where we had 17 bikes on the grid, and that wasn't enough. Therefore, we're starting from a position that I think none of us wanted to be in.
Yeah.
And nobody really predicted. So something had to be done. And fortunately, I think, that Dawn probably did foresee that there would be problems in filling the grid. They identified the problem and made a decision to go with CRT. And for all the criticism that the CRT has had, everybody I've spoken to, nobody has come up with a better plan within the restrictions we've got.
Yeah.
In terms of the money that is now available, or the lack of money that is available in the sport. So it has allowed us this year to have more than the 12 factory or satellite bikes on the grid that we might have had. And it's working well, in my opinion. After all the doom-mongers over the winter saying that we would be having people lapped on a regular basis, I've just had a look, and I think, other than France, which was because of the conditions, I think we've had one lap here this year.
And we've always had people getting lapped.
And we've always had people getting lapped. And at Catalunya, I think we had 20 people finish on the same lap.
Yeah.
Now, that for me is, if you finish on the same lap as the likes of Casey Stoner and Augie Lorenzo, you're a damn good motorcycle racer on a bike that is not too bad.
Yeah.
So, I think it's worked as well as it could be expected. And I think we've seen this weekend, we were having a look at the numbers yesterday, that Alex Espargaro is less than 3 seconds off pole, Randy Depunier is 3 seconds off pole, and that is not bad, Randy, which is quite a long track.
Yeah.
Espargaro is less than a second behind Valentino Rossi on a full factory bike. Now, personally, I would put most of that second down to the riders. I don't know about you.
Yeah.
The difference in riders. So, I looked at what Espargaro was like when he was on the factory machine or satellite machine in 2010, and he was 2.5 seconds off pole. So, maybe the CRT bikes are half a second down on some of the lesser successful factory bikes.
Yeah. I spoke to Colin Edwards yesterday, and that interview will be in the show as well, and I put to him that the CRT teams have almost had to continue testing in the start of the season. And he said, yeah, when they said we're going racing, he was like, what do you mean? I've got 18 tests more to do. Yeah. There is so much room for improvement there.
We were in very early stages of development. I think that the critical thing will be, do those teams that are running the CRT bikes have the resources to make vast improvements quickly? I don't think improvements will come quickly, but I think they will over the year. I'm not sure whether the factory guys, the right at the front, will not stand still, but I don't think they'll improve quite as quick. So it will close up, even more so than it is now.
And the start point, I think, is already less than some people were anticipating.
I totally agree. I think it's been a success as far as it goes. As I said, nobody I spoke to has come up with a better idea of what could have been done to fill the grid. So it has always been like this, though. And people were, I think we were spoiled to some extent in the years of the 990 era, as we call it, when we had relatively full grids, and the racing was close. And I think if we look back, that's almost the exception to the rule.
Mm.
people who've started watching during that era now think that the racing is not quite as exciting. But if we look back before that era, like I was just having a look at 1991, which is reckoned to be a great era with Rainey, Doon and Swans. Three guys who were battling at the front, like we have now, perhaps three top guys. But because the three guys battle at the front, they extend the races, they sort of stretch everybody out right from the start. Because if they don't do that, the other guy gets a drop on them and they're not going to win the race. And there are races in that season where regularly the guy finishing 10th was lapped.
Yeah.
On a regular basis. That was the norm. Sometimes the guy finishing 8th was lapped. And yet we look back on that era and say that it was a great era. Because we remember Swans doing and Rainey racing. But really, the field was probably was more spread out than what we've got now.
Because I think nostalgia is often is a kaleidoscope. It skews what you see. I mean, Kenny Roberts, wasn't he, said nostalgia is a disease. I wouldn't maybe go that far, but it is so easy to say, well, back in the day.
It is, and we've got to take off our rose-coloured spectacles.
Yeah.
And racing now is what it is. It's in the situation where I think the whole world is feeling the shocks of the economy. And for me, in the circumstances, we still have great racing.
Yeah.
This weekend, I think racing this year, one thing that makes good racing, in my opinion, is unpredictability. And we've seen that Casey Stoner has won at tracks he's not won at before, and we're perhaps not expected to win at. Olga Lorenzo has won at the tracks where Casey was normally winning. Yeah. So at the start of the race, you actually, like this weekend, do we know who's going to win? It could be Casey, it could be Olga, Ben Spies, the Dovey, you know, those sort of people could be on the podium. If conditions are a bit dodgy,
yeah.
Who knows who's going to win? Where in the exciting days of the 990 era, in actual fact, it was unusual if Valentino Rossi didn't win.
Yeah.
So one thing then was less unpredictability. I think now it's quite unpredictable, and yeah. I enjoy that. It's sitting here, I wouldn't like to. I'm not a betting man, but I wouldn't like to put my money on one particular person because there are several people in the mix who could win.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was interesting as well, the announcement made this week by Paul Bird that next year they'll be running two CRT bikes, and they're going to build their own chassis. Spoke to Lucio Ceccanello over the weekend, and he said he's very, as his background in engineering, he was a teenage mechanic, he said the challenge of building your own chassis from the bottom up and then putting an engine in that works well with it is very attractive. For the time being, he's going to remain as a Honda satellite team. But yeah, there certainly seems to be interest.
I think there is interest, and it is an engineering challenge for the smaller teams, and Paul Bird, I think he will find it a challenge to build a chassis that can meet the one he's got at the moment. But it will make it very interesting. All his team will be thoroughly enthused by that, by the challenge of it. What I do think, though, is the rules from now on should have some level of stability. What we cannot do is afford to cheese off the factory teams. The whole essence of Grand Prix racing for me is that we're seeing the best riders in the world on the fastest, most exclusive, most desirable bikes in the world. If we lose that by losing the factory teams, because there are some people who say, well, a grid of CRT machines, if we end up with that, that'll be fine. Not for me.
Mm.
I think we should have that dozen factory come satellite bikes that we've got now. Maybe if we get Suzuki back in a couple of years, we'll have 14 factory bikes and then maybe 8, 10 CRT, and I think we would have a fantastic grid with some great racing. So yeah. I think the future is good.
Yeah.
We're in a much better position, I feel, than we were 12, 18 months ago.
And we had 12 months ago, there were a couple of races where due to injuries or warm-up crashes and the like, that we started with 15.
Absolutely.
And you're starting to wonder if that actually can count as a race. There's this archaic rule, isn't there, that if it's less than 15, it can't count.
I agree. And all you need to do is just circle round, circulate, and you've got a point. And that's not what Grand Prix racing should be like now. I think people are comparing it a lot to negatively to what we had in the 990 era. But I do think that that was almost the exception to the rule of what went before that, where we had the four-cylinder two-strokes with a grid filled out with some twin cylinders and three cylinders and so on, which had no chance of winning.
Yeah.
There's never been an era where, at the start of the race, there's been more than half a dozen people who had a chance of winning the race. So I don't think this is any different than any other era, really.
Now, when we were speaking yesterday, you made a very interesting point, because I was expressing an opinion that I think a lot of people have, which is confusion over the limit of four bikes per manufacturer. But you made a very good point that if you have too many, and you have to limit them to the numbers, so some of the CRT bikes can realistically score points.
I think that's why the rule has been introduced. That's my interpretation of it. That if there are too many factory bikes on the grid, then what is the incentive to get somebody get involved with the CRT type bikes, because they've little chance of scoring points. But maybe the rule will be flexible, because who knows what the rule is. I think there's four or two factory bikes, two satellite bikes for each factory.
Yeah.
But will, for instance, Ducati, will they have two satellite bikes next year? We don't know. So it may be that the total cohort of factory come satellite bikes is 12,
yeah,
rather than it being necessarily four for each factory. I don't know.
Yeah.
But it seems to be a rule that should be flexible for the good of the sport, and should if somebody comes with a lot of money, for instance, let's take it for instance next year and say, right, we want a satellite Honda for Valentino Rossi, a fifth Honda. I think it'd be rather foolish for the rule makers to say, actually, no.
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely.
So I think it may be a rule that could be flexible.
And
but I don't know.
We're hearing this morning, and it's yet to be confirmed with a team press announcement, I believe, that Marc Marquez has been signed for Repsol Honda next year, and the rookie rule is being abolished.
Well, that's a new one. I've not picked up on that this morning.
It's been tweeted by a number of places, but the statement I've seen is from the Italian press. So it's we'll see if that does happen. But it's a perfect example of, for the good of the sport, this would be a good thing in the eyes of the organisers to allow.
Absolutely. So the rules there, but there may be rules that can be broken. Unlike maybe technical rules that are there and cannot be broken, maybe some of these less technical things can be flexible for the good of the sport.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's hope so.
Well, it's actually clouded over a bit, but hopefully it's going to remain dry. Looking forward to, hopefully, a good race here this afternoon. Dr. Martin Rains, thank you very much indeed for yet again giving us your thoughts for MotoPod, and we look forward to speaking to you again.
Thank you very much indeed, anytime.
Cheers.
Thanks.
So fascinating stuff from Martin. Thank you very much indeed. And he was charming company for the weekend. Like I said earlier, I was less starstruck than last year, but I was still a bit starstruck. and then we went racing. Now, because of the television schedules, and the European races all take place at 2 o'clock Central European time, it meant that the MotoGP race ran at 1 o'clock UK time, similar to we have at Estoril. So that shuffles up the order. So what we actually had was Moto2, then MotoGP, then Moto3. But the order we'll talk about them, we'll stick to our traditions, and we'll go Moto3, Moto2, MotoGP. Right. And Moto3, oh my God, Moto2 took a little while to get going. Moto3 has hit the ground running.
It has. It has. I mean, I have some thoughts, both positive and negative, about this. But I watched the race. Well, first of all, you know, qualifying was interesting because we had, Vinales, this is third pole of the year.
Yeah.
Efren Vasquez and Alexei Masbau, he's really, really coming on strong. You know,
isn't he just? Yeah.
It's obviously not a flash in the pan, so that's great. Sergio Cortesi, who's the championship leader leading into this round. Danny Kent, which is great because obviously you guys all wanted to see that.
Yeah.
And Louis Salom, who, you know, I only started noticing after Edwin Hazard pointed him out a few years ago. Just saying, just watch this guy race. And last year at Assen blew my mind, some of the stuff that Salom was pulling. And then Luis Rossi, who's coming on strong this year. Kai Verdin, which is great to see him there as well, obviously. And Romano Fanati, who is the temperature has gone down since that incredible win in Jerez, but he's still a sensation, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
But the race, the thing is, I watched the race, and I was half asleep because I had just finished watching all the other races, and I just wanted to nap because for us it was really early in the morning. I was up all night, and so I was kind of falling asleep. But I was just like. You know, I wasn't sure what lap it was, but there was just such a battle going on. I ended up watching it again, and and with a virtual pencil and paper, I started keeping track of all the passes for the lead. And what I decided to do is I said, okay, I'm going to count a lead change as a corner to corner. In other words, like you can't just go through the corner and then go wide and then get repassed. Doesn't count. You have to actually make it stick.
Right?
Yeah. So I said, okay, I'm going to count every one that stuck, every lead change that stuck. And there were 31 lead changes. There were 31 lead changes, six different leaders in this race.
And that's in what, 17 laps, I think, didn't they?
So I know this may be kind of boring, but I'm just going to run through because it was amazing. So the whole shot was not Mats Bauls, but he took over at the lead. Then he was passed by Vasquez, who was very aggressive, but clean for once. And I love the little comment that Gavin Emmett made on the MotoGP.com podcast where he said, "I think it probably is safest to have Vinales in the front." You know, but that wasn't to be because then Maspel came past him and Vinales before the end of the lap. So Vinales was officially on the lap charts, leading lap one. But then Salom came on and Vinales passed him again. Lap three, Salom passed Vinales and stuck it to the end of the lap. Then Vasquez came in, and you know, this was a group of 11 riders.
Yeah.
Between 6 and 11 riders that were bunched up in the front, swapping positions. So, like, the lead changes were just part of the story because we were also having a battle for 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, all in the same group.
You made a bigger point that wide tracks and small formula, you know, the difference in lines they were taking. Remember, at Catalonia, we had this train of 8 riders. You know, Vinales had buggered off out front, but the battle for second place was 8 riders, absolutely nose to wheel, nose to wheel. Here, there were times when it looked like the grid was racing in grid formation. It was like 4 abreast coming down towards Stowe. And it was like,
I believe in one place, it was actually 6 riders that had at least a wheel
overlapping.
Yeah. I mean, it was unbelievable. You know, I'm looking forward to Brno with these guys because it could happen again.
Yeah.
So then we had, you know, Vasquez came up, Vinales, Salom, Masbao, Cortese came just barreling out of nowhere. It was like, oh, wait a second, that's Cortese. Wasn't he like in fourth, you know?
Yeah.
Vinales, this is only in lap 6 now. We're only in lap 6. Salom takes over. Vinales, Rossi. I mean, it was just amazing, you know, on and on.
We only had lap 11 and lap 12 where there wasn't a leader change. They were the only 2 laps where someone didn't get someone else.
Exactly.
And the final lap.
Well, in the final lap, yeah. But the one note about lap 12 was that that was the only time also where there was actual separation between these two groups where there was only 2 riders up front, or 3 riders up front, sorry, and then a couple of bike lengths. And then the second group, and I think Masbao actually was holding some people back. So whenever he was not leading that second group would edge towards the front guys. And whenever he was leading that group, they would edge back.
Yeah.
And then, you know, then we got to the final lap, and And actually, it was on lap 14 was the first time where we had where Vinales pulled up a lead, and it looked like he was going to finally get away.
Pull the pin, yeah.
But it didn't happen because Salam came on. I don't know where he found the speed. He just basically just decided not to use the brakes anymore or something because he came back. Seriously, he came back and passed him yet again. And then Vinales finally used some power and got past him, and it's just amazing. Incredible.
So the final positions, Vinales won by less than a second from Salom, who was a tenth ahead of Sandro Cortese. Now,
really?
Cortese had led, or not led, but he'd led Salom for most of that final lap. And I was thinking, Vinales must be thinking, can no one else beat this blooming pesky German? Because he's just, you know, if I win, he comes second. If I come second, he comes third.
Right.
You know, because obviously he was the championship leader. And Salom actually did a pretty good mugging to get in front, coming into the final set of corners. Vale and Club before the finish line, which is really early. You know, they're still cranked over almost when they cross the finish line. Then we had Alex Maspu, Efren Vasquez, Danny Kent, who'd been 10th or 11th, I think, starting that final lap. Sorry, no, 9th he'd have been starting that final lap. And he managed to come through Fanati, who was 7th, Arthur Sissis was 8th, and Zulfami Karadin was 9th. And that was the lead group. Okay, I mean, you had the lead three, then 7 seconds back, you had this group of six who paces beat each other up for 17 laps.
Brilliant
to watch. Absolutely fantastic.
Where did you get to see it? Where did you watch it? Did you watch it in the media center, or were you on the
obviously
track?
Obviously, I missed the very beginning because I went down and recorded the start. Mm-hmm. Of the Vuvuzela class, because last year I did the same for the 125s, and I thought it'd be interesting by comparison. And so I went back up to the media center where you just got information overload.
Yeah.
But I mean, as we said before, lap charts, they only update once every lap. It's a snapshot when you pass there. But even the intermediate times are way behind what you're actually seeing on the screen. But you get the Dorna feed, the MotoGP.com feed, so you'd get a Gavin Emmett and Nick Harris, which is, you know, great to listen to. And Ian Wheeler was doing some of the Moto3 commentary as well.
Yeah.
And he said about a third of the way through, he said, I'm going to have to go for a lie down. I'm exhausted. I've only done a third of a race.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was brilliant. And it does mean that Vinales has now taken the championship lead, 105 points. Cortese, 103. Then Luis Salom in third on 75. He's more than a race win away from Cortese. And he's a race win and a 11th place from Maverick Vinales. So it is becoming a two-horse race.
Yes.
Romano Fanati is fourth with 61 points. Luis Rossi fifth with 45, so on and so forth down the line. So, for Delete Tirol, insert Cortese. Here you go, Maverick. Have a go at another bloody persistent rider.
Yep.
Interesting to see how that one develops. Then, but of course, actually, much earlier that morning, we had Moto2, where it did look like we might have a little bit of rain for this one. As it happened, it stayed dry. Qualifying had gone well. We'd had Paul Espargaró on pole, Andrea Iannone and Scott Redding making up the front row, with Bradley Smith, who always runs well at home. Mark Marquez and Claudio Corti were row two. Tom Luthi down in seventh, Johann Zarco and Alex De Angelis. Simone Corsi, Dominic Agata, Randy Krumenacker making up row four. And Gino Rea with his best qualifying so far in 14th, middle of the fifth row, with Robbie Rolfo ahead of him and Mike D'Amelio just behind.
And Nicolas Tirol in 27th.
Yeah. It's clearly something is not going well with Nick Tirol. And this is a point being made by some people, you know, where remember Estoril 2010 and my birth of a legend comment with Marquez. I'm now wondering whether that needs some revision, which is, it might seem strange. I'm not sure he's going to be the next and I'm not trying to compare him with riding styles or personality or anything like that, but in terms of his ability to win, I'm not sure he's the next Lorenzo or Stoner. I'm not sure he's not going to be the next Simoncelli. I think he's blisteringly quick. But I was looking at this and I thought, with Trob, we don't know how these guys will do when they move up. And some you think would do better than others and don't. Mm. Now, you could put it down to machinery, but you look at what Bautista achieved on the Suzuki and what he's doing on the Gresini. And then you look at Hector Barbera. And Hector Barbera is mugging himself off. Anyway, we'll talk about that when we come on to MotoGP. But no, my point is with Nico Tirole is a good rider in one class won't necessarily be able to translate to being a good rider in another class.
Yeah, you know. Tony Elias is another great example, right?
Yeah, yeah, totally.
And the thing is, Tony Elias was good in the premier class. It's just that the changes that happened in his absence were just completely incompatible with the way he rides.
Yes.
And he was unable to or unwilling to change, one of those two.
I mean,
actually, a combination of them.
I heard someone, a journalist said last year at some stage, I can't remember if it was on a rival podcast or not, but the word from the team was when they say, look, we've changed the bike as much as we can. We can't change the tyres because it's a control tyre. So the other variable is you need to change. And the response I got is, but I won a MotoGP race. It's like, yeah, you did. That was 4 years ago, and it was a very different world.
Yeah,
it was a different sized engine, you know, everything. So, but again, this race was it was very, very interesting right from the start to the finish. And at the end of lap one, we had two British leaders. We had Bradley Smith and Scott Redding beating each other up at the front, which was just great to see. I mean, Bradley got a cracking start. Usual suspects were bunched up behind them. We had Corti, Iannone, Corsi, Marquez. Luthi struggled to keep up. Mm-hmm. Zarco up there initially. And then Zarco was quite an early DNF. He crashed, didn't he? He crashed, made it back out onto the track, but had to retire.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah. Unfortunately, in his special livery, orange, bike, but so off we went, and Bradley really quickly got chewed up in the first few laps and sent backwards, and I did think he was going to end up going completely backwards, but he sort of rallied, and Scott Redding got caught up with and passed by Paul Espargaro eventually. Mark Marquez was up there with him. Iannone was up there with him, and Scott's had this problem where he is a big lad, his tyre wear has got to exceed other people's anyway, and his riding style, which is so entertaining to watch, can't be good for tyre longevity. So we all expected him to drop off, and by bugger did he not. Now Paul Espargaro got out front, and you could almost picture the trademark Espargaro grin inside the helmet. And he was actually he was a bit of a dull element of it. And I don't mean that to say he's dull, but because he got out front and didn't really, even though he never broke away massively, but he wasn't really threatened.
No.
But Scott Redding and Mark Marquez just.
Unbelievable battle. What a great battle. And you know that Scott actually, I don't know if it was him that I heard saying or one of the crew that said that he has definitely decided to try a different approach to the riding. It's not just settings that kept him going to the end of the race. He's now realizing, you know what? I'm just not riding this bike for race distance. I have to change that.
No, absolutely. I don't know what the state of his tires were at the end. I didn't see any pictures or hear any comments, but you know, the proof was in the pudding, and he and Marc Marquez had a last lap that was a Moto2 equivalent almost to Catalunya 2009. They were just walloping each other out the way. But I say that, not ridiculously aggressively, but there was some really hard but clean passing going on. Mm-hmm. And then Marquez had a bit of a wobble on one of the rumble strips running out. Scott got past, and it was a case of you knew – because you come into that final, you've got the left, then you've got the right, then you've got the right again onto the start-finish straight and the finish line. And you knew that Marquez was going to try and dive up the inside, and Scott Redding just went round the outside, held it, and it was almost elbow out. You will not come past. And Scott got second place, and he looked incredibly happy. Yeah. He was going around. I mean, the roar, you could hear it from inside the media center. Andrea Iannone came in fourth. Corsi was fifth with Corti sixth. Bradley Smith, a good seventh. Tom Lethe, eighth. Which sort of damages his 8 points is not what he'd expected. He was quiet all weekend, though, Tom Lethe. Mm-hmm. Dominic Agutu was ninth, Mika Kallio 10th, Alex De Angelis 11th, Tony Elias 12th, Esteban Rabat, Randy Krumenacker, and Ratapark Willerot rounded out the points. Well, that means that Marquez is in the lead with 102 points. In the championship, Paul Espargaró and Tom Lethe both tied on 96. Now, it is worth bearing in mind that Marc Marquez has a potential. What did he get at Catalonia? 16 points.
Yeah.
So he might potentially lose 16 because right. We're still waiting for the final decision on the appeal put in by Paul Espargaró's team. So, yeah. So that may drop to, he may actually. Dropped to 80, what would it be? 86 points.
Right.
Which would put him into the clutches of Andrea Iannone, who's in fourth place on 84, Scott Redding on 70.
Well, those guys actually still have him in clutches anyway, because that's they're all within a race win. So,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
And I did want to say, you know, the real proof for Scott Redding, whether if he finally figured this thing out, it's not really Silverstone, because he's always done well at Silverstone. In fact, his record at Silverstone is ridiculously, like, consistent.
Well, his record, some of that was at Donington, remember. He's still the youngest ever GP winner, right. Which was done. But his home round GP, he does not suffer from the home round GP curse, which some riders seem to. More of that later. Mm-hmm. And whether that's just bad luck or pressure, who can tell? But Scott, no, he seems to absolutely flourish at the home round. Yeah.
And one thing I wanted to say before we move off of Moto 2 is that so I got very interested in this in watching Moto 3 seems to me very similar to 2010 in Moto 2, where it was very exciting and you never knew who was going to really win. And I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that the teams were still not quite sure what to do with the bikes in year one, right? So round to round, there were completely varied settings. I mean, sometimes Tony Elias won a race, sometimes he came in like, you know, 12th. So Iannone was an even bigger factor where he was all over the place, right? So what I did is I kind of looked at the seasons of 2010 and 2011. And wrote down all the winners and all the podium, the people that ended up on the podium, and compared the variance basically. And in 2010 we had 9 different winners, and only 2 of them had repeats. So we had Elias with 6 wins, Iannone with 3, but then we had Tamazawa, Kluzel, Takahashi, Rolfo, De Angelis, Brattle, and Abraham all with 1 race win. And we had 16 different podium finishers with 5 repeats. I'm not going to go through all those guys, but in 2011, we only had 6 different winners, and 3 of them were repeats. And frankly, the other 3 were truly. First of all, Luthi and Pirro in the last 2 rounds, they won the last 2 rounds. Marquez wasn't even racing then anymore because he was hurt.
Yeah, from last year, of course, yeah.
Yeah, in 2011. So I think it would have been very different if Marquez had been there. So you can see. Immediately, and just in one season, how much? On podiums we had 8 repeaters instead of just 5 in 2010. So you can see that the teams figured out, you know, with their riders, they start to figure out what to do with these bikes, and now the real rider skill, I think, started to matter. So I think that we're going to see the same thing in Moto 3. I think Moto 3 is all over the place. Plus, the guys are a lot younger too, so there's learning going on there as well, and core bones and whatever.
But I
do think that we're starting to see a solidification of the Moto2 class now, where you can expect Paul Espargaro, Marc Marquez, Scott Redding, at least for half a race, you know.
Yeah.
Thomas Luthig, the same names. You start to hear the same names. You're not surprised. Like, are you saying that you know, like Kyle Abraham winning Valencia in 2010? I mean, that was an aberration that year.
Yeah, and I also think it's interesting to see the spread of chassis as we've talked about. You know, a lot of people have gone from Suter to Kalex, but no one's particularly dominating. And one thing I did want to mention about Moto3, remember in pre-season testing, people were saying, well, the only Honda that can compete with the KTMs is Vinales. You know, everyone else is really suffering. KTM's a bike to have. And look at the championship. It's Vinales on a Honda, Cortese on a KTM, Salom on a KTM, Fanati on a Honda,
yeah.
Rossi on a Honda, Rins on a Suter Honda. So you've got FTR Hondas and Suter Hondas. You know, it's Honda, KTM, KTM, Honda, 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 KTM. It's a really good mix. And I think the same thing in Moto2, that it's great to see that the chassis builders are competing as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm almost like, if it ain't fixed, don't break it. Do we really need to go to open engines, you know, open engine competition? Will there be that much interest? Will from Yamaha, Kawasaki, Suzuki, whoever?
It's kind of like what Martin Raines was saying in the interview you guys did. You don't, maybe it's time to stop messing with the rules.
Yeah.
You know?
And when it comes up, just say, okay, Yamaha, do you want to go at making an engine? Because remember, the original spec for Moto 2 is it had to be able to do a certain amount of distance and it had to make 150 horsepower. And Yamaha looked at it and went, yeah, we can't do that with the resources available, and withdrew from the competition. Honda said, yeah, we can do it. And then during development, they went, well, when we said 150, that's the target. We're probably going to be more like 125. So they got lower power output than World Supersport. But again, the naysayers who were like, oh, it's, you know, it's a dumbed down class. World Supersport's faster. Not anymore, they're not.
Yeah.
Well, Moto 2 are faster than World Supersport. Now, how much that's down to riders, how much that's down to chassis, I don't know. But they're doing it with quite significantly less power.
Yeah.
So it's like, no, this is good. This is working. And with that lower horsepower.
Was it Peter Jacobson that talked to Jim and was talking about the Moto 2 bikes?
No, wasn't it Tommy Aquino?
Oh, it was Aquino. That's right. It was Aquino.
And he was saying it's incredible. He said, and in isolation, each of the differences are tiny, but cumulatively, you know, every single bolt is titanium. Every washer is titanium. You know, there's no excess bit of carbon fiber anywhere. It's all trimmed down to the minimum, and it just makes such a difference. And the adjustability.
Yeah.
I think it was Tommy, or it might have been.
No, you're right. You're right.
Yeah. So then we went to MotoGP, and it is worth a slight retrospect of FP3 Saturday morning. There were quite a few crashes. And in FP3, we had Cal Crutchlow crashed and fractured, dislocated his left ankle. And as was mentioned earlier, went off to have a scan. I listened to his post-race conference, which I didn't record because there was a massive scrum of journalists there. And I was actually there to interview Andrea Dovizioso. But I listened to a bit. What this guy had to do to prove his fitness. Well, the doctor, who was a specialist at John Ratcliffe Hospital, I think he went to in Oxford or whichever hospital he went to, he was a specialist in joint injuries, said, you won't be racing for 4 rounds. So he was looking at Cal not coming back till post-Mugello. He then had to come back with the results to the Clinica Mobile team, the race medical team, and persuade them he was fit to race. And he, as he put it, he said, so I told a few lies. And then they made him, he had to run up and down the room 20 times. He then had to do 20 lifts onto his toes on both feet, 10 on the injured foot. And he said the one that really hurt, because it's his gear change foot, was he had to rock on his heels and lift his toes up 10 times. And he said that was agony, not showing the pain and saying, you know, yeah, it's a bit uncomfortable, but no, I can deal with that. And the doctor's going, oh, okay. Then he had to do warm-up, and he had to do warm-up at a sufficient pace to show that he was not just circulating. And you just think, wow, yes, these people are not normal.
No, and they were calling him the honey badger before this weekend.
Oh, he had it on his leathers, yeah. But he absolutely lived up to the honey badger. If anyone doesn't know what a honey badger is, just look it up on Wikipedia or on YouTube. They're there. Yes, they're ferocious little African animals.
Honey badgers don't care.
No, honey badgers don't care about anything or anyone. And it's a perfect moniker for Cal. It was incredible. Also in QP, we saw Rossi crash. And there was a lot of debate about this. We basically, the qualifying period was running. We had Alvaro Bautista putting in some blinding laps, and he got a real flyer with about 5 minutes to go, and then it rained.
Right.
So it kind of, and in the qualifying press conference, which is unfortunately audio we can't broadcast, but we can quote from, he pretty much acknowledged, you know, I got lucky with the rain. But as we'll see in the race, he was pretty much good for that. It wasn't a fluke.
Mm-hmm.
But the one thing that did happen was coming in towards Stowe, there is a downhill, then an uphill, and then just before you tip in, it crests. So your front is compressed and then goes light. And Rossi had one of those Tony Elias crashes where he's not even started to turn and the front just tucked and slammed him down. And then a few laps later, Nicky Hayden had exactly the same crash in exactly the same place.
And if you watch it closely, you'll see that it happens an instant after the rear lifts. So the moment that the bike loses traction in the rear is when, well, it loses traction. There is no more traction because the rear lifts from braking.
Yeah.
It was at that exact moment that they just went down. So it was like the front tire, I mean, not the front tire, but basically the front of the bike just completely collapses.
Yeah.
Because that crash with Rossi, I was sure he was going to be out cold. His helmet slammed into the ground so hard, I thought he would have had a concussion, you know?
Now, there was a talk after saying that Rossi had said the airbag saved his collarbone. But then since then, people said, no, the airbag, it happened so quick, the airbag didn't go off until after it impacted. So,
oh, wow.
But again, Rossi is generally a very safe crasher, and he didn't hurt himself.
And neither did Nicky.
Neither did Nicky. They both went down. But as a result of which, their qualifying position wasn't what it could have been. Because it is a massive circuit. Now, okay, they're not that far from the pits there, but it is a huge circuit. And to get back, there is not one track. There's no access track that runs around the whole of the inside.
Didn't Rossi actually ran down the pit lane, didn't he?
I think Rossi ran back from where that was. But
it was towards the end of the lap. I mean, it was at Valle, which is kind of.
Sorry, that's right. It was Valle crashed at Vale.
Yeah. So. The Ian Wheeler made a great comment that later got talked about quite a bit at the post-QP conference, which was that maybe it's the tire, because if it is in fact softer, and they both got caught out by it, maybe this tire that Stoner and Danny have been complaining about gives them too little feel actually hurt both the Ducati and both Ducati riders, you know. And Stoner made a good point, which is that he said, well, Rossi crashed there last year too.
Yeah. But he also said it's not the first time we've seen all the Ducatis crash at the same point.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we've had it this year, last year. He said, you know, when I was on the Ducati, there were times where I'd go down, you know, I'm trying to think who his teammate was, but Melandri, mm-hmm. I suppose, at one stage, you know, but all the Ducatis would go down at the same point. And then he kind of backed away from implying it was a Ducati thing and saying, and we've had other times when the Hondas have gone down. And I remember being at Assen in 2009 and watching Danny crash in turn one, well, go down at the front, washed out, and he slid off. And about three laps later, Dovi went down in exactly the same place. And the scratch mark his bike left was like 2 feet from the one Danny's did. So there are those strange ones. Mm. But yeah, it was, Bautista and Spies were both asked about it as well. And they basically said, no, we didn't have a problem that corner, but you know, don't know. And then Casey weighed in. And it was interesting to see Casey around the paddock and in the QP conference and places. I've never seen him so smiley, but then I don't normally get to see him that much.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, he just seems really relaxed, happy. Interesting. So the front row was Bautista, Spies and Stoner. Second row was Lorenzo.
You know, one more thing about the QP conference, because Bautista said that he doesn't mind the – he was asked specifically. I think it was maybe even David Emmett that asked him about the tire. What he thought of this tire that Danny is actually much more upset about than Casey, it sounds like, you know. But
well, Danny's decided it's a conspiracy to slow the Hondas down. And Casey just said, nah, it just doesn't suit us, but don't worry, we'll make it work.
Right. Whereas Bautista said it didn't bother him. And the first thought is, well, you know, it's a satellite bike. But you got to remember, that is also a factory bike. So I'm wondering just how factory is it?
It's last year's chassis.
It is last year's chassis.
So last year's chassis has worked well. It's the chassis they all started with this season with, which was the same one they finished last season with.
Yep.
But HRC, the Repsol team, have had the new chassis.
Right.
And Alvaro hasn't. Right. And I don't know, but the feeling talking to and listening to eavesdropping basically on the journos in the media center is that Bautista's level of support is not what Simoncelli's was.
I'm not at all surprised. That's exactly what went through my head. Was like, it's not that he's not fast enough to get into that zone where that tire starts to hurt him. It's I think that the bike is just very different.
Yeah, I think he's closer to HRC spec than Bradle with the LCR, but he's still not at the level Casey and Danny are, which looks like it's helping. So the front row was Bautista Speed Stoner. Then we had Lorenzo Pedrosa, Hector Barbera. I think it's worth mentioning. His personal manager needs to advise him, stop towing people to get a fast qualifying lap because it's making you look bad because you always finish lower than your qualifying position and no one likes a one-lap wonder.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't make you look good. The perception is, you know, I mean, Jakob Smirts in World Superbikes, can pull out a blinding fast lap in the races. He's very rarely troubling the podium guys. Then we had Nicky Dovi. Dovi doing his classic, it's qualifying.
Right.
And Stefan Bradl. The fourth row was Rossi, and then the first Rossi was the slowest of the production bikes, other than Cal, who didn't take part in QP.
And Carole,
Espargaro and DiPugno, and Carole Abraham was not cleared fit. The crash he had testing at Aragon, unfortunately, his hand looks a right mess. Don't know if you saw the pictures of it.
I did. No, actually, during the Moto 3 race, he was helping with the commentating, or maybe Moto 2, I think, I think he started to show it to Nick Harris. He was like, and Nick Harris was just like, whoa, put that thing back on.
Yeah.
I do not want to see that.
So at Rossi, Spargo, DiPugno, Hernandez, Pirro, Colin Edwards, Pacini, Ellison, Petrucci, and Ivan Silva in 19th, all on his own with two non-qualifiers, although, of course, Cal did start the race. the race, I mean, I think it was actually someone in the press, in the media center yelled, wow, look at the start Lorenzo's had. And of course it wasn't Lorenzo, it was Spies.
Mm-hmm.
Ben Spies got an absolute blaster. And Danny didn't, unusually for Danny. And we had, basically we had Bautista, Spies, and then quickly followed by, Nicky Hayden.
Yeah.
Nicky got a cracking start. We're leading off, and Stoner, Lorenzo, and Pedrosa were kind of in the pack, but not near the front. And Ben got himself to the front reasonably quickly. Followed by Bautista and Nicky. And then the three you'd expect to see up there started to make their way through. Casey, first of all. And it was just another absolutely, you know, riveting race. And Bautista, you know, all the comments made, well, you know, he only got pole because it rained. Well, that might be true, but he certainly was on the pace.
Mm-hmm.
Now, by the end of the first lap, Cal had gone from 20th to I think something like 13th, and it was like, wow, you know, he really is on the move. And a lot of attention was being paid to, not by the television producers so much, but certainly by people looking at timing sheets, his progression, and it was just ridiculous. It was crazy. And this was funny, actually. I was sat looking at the screens one way. Matt Burt from Motorcycle News was sat across looking another way. And I tweeted, he said, you know, Cal's already up to, and I think that put him, I think he was 11th. And I said, yeah, but Ross is 3.5 seconds ahead, tweeted back. And we could have spoken to each other about it rather than tweeting it. We were that close. And then Matt came straight back with, yeah, and look at the split times. And it was like, geez, he was taking chunks out of Rossi.
Yeah.
And then obviously his progression slowed, but he went past Rossi, Bradle, Barbera. He caught Nicky in the final laps, but we'll get to that because meanwhile up front, it was all going off. Ben ran wide, letting a couple of people through, and we ended up with Casey, followed by Bautista, and then we had Lorenzo closing down Ben, got past Ben, and he was kind of bringing Danny along with him, and they seemed to take a while to warm up. Stoner got past Bautista, Lorenzo got past Bautista, and then we had this absolutely brilliant... Guy Anderson summed up perfectly. He said they nip and tuck between Lorenzo and Stoner for a couple of laps, he said, and I've rarely seen trust that expressed that clearly, the way these two guys are riding each other. You know, there was a couple of times where someone would go round. You've got a lot of corners at Silverstone where it's a left, then a right, then a left, then a right. So yeah. The inside line for the first corner is only works if you can get far enough ahead to close the door for the second corner. Otherwise, you just find yourself getting taken straight back. And there were times where the guy on the inside could have gone wide and pushed the other guy, you know, given the old center, Ayrton Senna thing of, you know, well, you either slow down, you either back off or you hit me. Right. And they didn't. And I think the mutual respect between those guys is quite clear. I'm not sure they describe themselves as friends, but they certainly get on, and they certainly have faith in each other.
Yes.
And it was brilliant to see. But then Lorenzo got through and he started to pull a gap. Then it closed back in, and then we saw why. He had a big moment, nearly lifted out the seat and went back and then started to pull it out again. And in the end, Lorenzo won by just over three seconds. Casey was harried by Danny Pedrosa. And initially, Bautista, they did not drop him.
No.
He stuck with him. And in the end, was only a second and a half off Casey and Danny. Danny never really got close enough to make a lunge at the end. Then we had, Bautista was fourth, very happy with that. Ben Spies. And there was a shot of the leaders coming down, I think it was Hanger Straight, or it might have been under the Wellington
exactly.
Bridge.
Yes, exactly, in the background.
And in the background, going from left to right, and I just saw dark, followed by red, and yelled, Cal's got through. And a few people went, eh? And it wasn't reflected on the intermediate timing screen until after we'd seen him. And we didn't see the pass today. Oh, no, that's right. I think they did go back and show it.
They did.
But sixth place from plum last with a fracture dislocated left ankle is like...
And have you ever had anything dislocated, God. Martin?
No.
It's so much worse than a break. I've had a broken wrist. You just you break something, unless it's a rib, you just stick it in the cast. With dislocation, it's like, yeah, you can put... It's horrible. The pain is horrible, you know. I just can't... the guy's a honey badger. Anyway, I found Nicky unbelievably exciting.
Yeah.
He was amazing. He was amazing. Obviously, he had to overwork the bike and the tires, and in the end, he had nothing left to ride on. And he even said
In warm-up, he was second fastest in the dry.
Yeah,
there's nothing funny about warm-up. But
I know.
They have said it. Obviously, it was cooler in the morning. The Ducati prefers cool conditions. Nicky was really impressive until at the end. And Ben had the same thing. Ben Spies' rear tire, he somehow mullered it. It was gone.
Yeah.
And we had Ben, Cal, Nicky, Stefan Bradl in eighth. Another very proficient run by Stefan. Valentino Rossi in ninth. Oh my God.
Fourteen seconds
behind Bradl.
Yeah.
Hector Barbera 5 seconds behind Valentino. So at least he wasn't the slowest Ducati. Then we had Aleix Espargaró and Randy Depuña had another brilliant teammate on teammate dust up. Mm-hmm. It was just good to see. We didn't see that much of them. Michele Pirro was 13th, and James Ellison and Yonny Hernandez. James put an absolutely cracking move in on Yonny to just pip 14th. So a couple of great points there for James Ellison, who looked quite happy this weekend despite a warm-up high side, which looked quite painful. Yonny Hernandez was 15th, and Colin just outside the points with Petrucci, Silva, and Andrea Dovizioso, who's been given a finish. But unfortunately, for the first time in ages, a point you made earlier, I don't know how many races that Dovi's consecutive races he scored points in, Dovi actually crashed, managed to remount, but the brake protector was knackered.
Mm.
So he had to go in, and there was a shot of him and yelling with Guy Coulon, and he's like, you know, what can we do? And they said, no, you're going to have to go on the other bike. But of course, on the other bike, you had to go out on wet tyres. Right. So it's like, okay, this isn't worth it. But this is the good bit about having a larger grid. You can't have someone who just goes out and you know,
circulates for a point. Yeah.
Yeah, on a paddock scooter and circulates for a point because there's too many of us. And the other DNF was Pessini, who'd had to drop out earlier with, I think, some kind of mechanical. So that leaves us with Jorge Lorenzo is leading the championship 140 points. So he is now the full 25 clear of Casey Stoner on 115, Danny on 101, then a big gap back to Cal, 66, Dovi, 60, Rossi, 58, tied with Bautista on 58, and only 7 points behind him, Stefan Bradl.
Yeah.
In his debutant season, Nicky Hayden on 49, Hector Barbera on 37. It was just another three great races, and I can't get the angst some people are going on about this season. This is some of the best racing, consistent best racing we've had for years.
I can't remember. Yes. It's been a decade at least since I've seen this kind of racing consistently.
Yeah, yeah. You know? And yes, we had some brilliant races in 800s, and sometimes after the first couple of races this season, people were saying, you know, thank God for that. This is great. 800s are rubbish. None of the races were any good. And you think, well, that's not true. There were some brilliant races, but they were kind of, they probably seemed better because they were in isolation. But we are having a really, really good season. This is,
the best
I would
season
say,
ever.
Definitely the best season since the last best season.
Dude,
ever.
I mean, it's not just MotoGP. I mean, Superbikes has also delivered some unbelievably great racing this season.
Yeah.
We're really lucky.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And I just think, yeah, let's just
enjoy it.
It is what it is. If you're a MotoGP fan, this is MotoGP. Be a fan, you know. And unless someone's, you know, planning to a hostile takeover of Dorna, you don't get a say in it. You get a say in it, but no one's going to listen. So, no, I just think of course it could be better. Everything could be better. But I ain't complaining.
No,
this is pretty damn good. And
so let's play Andrea and Bradl.
Yeah. So this is Andrea Dovizioso post race, and it's worth bearing in mind this guy's just crashed.
Yeah.
You know, and surrendered his championship position to Cal, to his teammate, who's only 6 points ahead. But you know, the old adage that the first person you have to beat is your teammate. Mm-hmm. So
and it's
here we go.
It's very, very clear that that's what they're doing in Tech Trois.
Yeah. Yeah. And here's Dovi. Andreas, Martin from MotoPod with Andrea Dovizioso. Tough day today, but for the season so far, it's making the decision to come to Yamaha look pretty good. But how difficult was that decision to leave Honda?
Yeah, sure. After many years in Honda, it's not so easy because you have many question marks. You never tried different bike. But I thought at that time what Honda gave me wasn't good enough for me because I have a big objective, because I want to win, I want to win the championship. Like that, I didn't have the possibility. So I swapped to Yamaha, I believe in Yamaha, and this is the result. I think what we made until now is really good.
Yeah, I spoke to Hervé on Friday, and he said you and Cal are the two strongest riders he's had. But you do know you make him nervous?
when you're racing together so close, and your results. I mean, until today, with unfortunately with a crash here, and you've run well here before, so that's a great shame. But until now, your worst results, 7th and 8th, when you both crashed and remounted. I mean, what do you feel's happened to make Tectoire and you and Cal together such an effective team?
But there's many things together. I mean, the 1000 of Yamaha burn really well. This is important. And I think Tectoire is a really good team because they're working with a passion. And it's really important on the bike to working with that type of person.
Yeah.
And I think me and Carl, we have a big talent, so that's why the reason is we are always there.
You seem to have very different styles,
yeah.
And yet the bike is able to suit both of you because your times are so close.
Yes, but to make the speed of Lorenzo is different because I think Lorenzo riding Yamaha in the best way, because also Ben, also Carl can make the lap time of Lorenzo, but they can't finish the race with Lorenzo.
Yeah.
It's because the way how you're riding is really important for to keep in a good situation the tires, the bike, and the energy of the body. This is the difference of Lorenzo and everybody.
Yeah. Well, looking forward, you're going to Assen next. It's suited the Yamahas before. Are you looking forward?
Assen is not one of my favorite tracks, but from the first race to now, I always improved. So, I mean, this season is different than all my season. And I think we are really strong and fast to fight for the podium. So I'm really, really confident. And especially after this race, you really want to race as soon as you can, because you feel you have the power and the possibility to fighting to make a good position. And we had the possibility today, and I had the bad luck. So
you made some great passes before the crash, though. It was really entertaining.
And I think if I didn't crash, it was beautiful to finish the race with everybody, because sure, I finished the race with Honda.
Yeah. Well, best of luck for the rest of the season, Andrea.
Yes.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you. So, thank you, Andrea. Very, very eloquent, thoughtful young man, and charming. And I did think it was interesting what he said about the differing styles, where he said, but the way to make this bike work best is Lorenzo. And this is something that I'm starting, you know, as a Brit, obviously, I'd love to see Cal on a factory bike. I'd love to see the first British podium since Jeremy McWilliams in 2000. I think, and this is me trying to be objective as possible, and I'll probably get some hate mail, I think in terms of going further, even though he's been around a while, I think Dovi's got more potential on this bike at this time than Cal. And I'm sorry.
I think I agree with you.
Because he's identified, and as we were just talking pre-show, this is a guy who bumped fairings with Jorge Lorenzo. This is a guy who, if Jorge hadn't been there, Dovi was Max Biaggi to Lorenzo's Rossi. You know, if he hadn't been there, if Lorenzo hadn't been there, Dovi would have been a world champion in 250s.
Twice.
But twice. And they did not see eye to eye about a lot of things. So, they've got older, they've mellowed, I'm sure. And there is a mutual respect there without the shadow of a doubt. But that's a really gutsy thing for a racer to say. To ride this bike best, you have to ride it like him.
Yep.
You know, that's real analytical honesty.
When Ben Spies was talking about the Yamaha and was asked about the leg waving thing.
Yeah.
You remember this? And he said, well, Lorenzo doesn't do it.
Yeah.
You know?
And isn't it funny how so many of them do it?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like someone should do a little video clip doing it boards before about to do the okie kokie. Because it's getting like that. But Lorenzo, he said, I tried it and that just made me feel uncomfortable and didn't make me go any faster. So I'm not doing it.
Right.
I remember Leon Haslund doing the same thing. They looked at data at his dad's race school to see. And he went, nope, doesn't make any difference to me. Might do to other people. So he's just sticking with the flappy paddle kneecap with Leon changing gear. But I thought the thing with Dovi was interesting to highlight that. And
I also think when someone can be that analytically honest, it kind of gives a lot of credence to everything else they say, because there's not an ego at play here. This is not someone trying to make themselves look good. This is someone just being really honest. And it reminded me of when someone said to Cal, do you have access to the data of the other guys? And he said, yeah. And they said, what, even Jorge Lorenzo? And he went, yeah, he said, I see Lorenzo's data. Sometimes I wish I didn't. And it is, it's just because it's like, shit, I can't do that. Right. But it's fascinating, as we said to Hervé, to have such contrasting styles being so close together.
Yeah.
But then we also got to speak to Stefan Bradl, and I'm going to stick my neck out here and say that this, I think this boy has got a really bright future. He is such a thinker. Now, I know you've taken the mickey out of me in the past, you know, the love affair with Marc Márquez. I don't really, but I do think the kid has got blistering talent. But he didn't name any names in this interview. But when you listen to Stefan talking about the thought processes, I think you can substitute the name Márquez in there somewhere.
Oh, yeah.
But anyway, let's roll it.
Yep.
And it's Martin with from MotoPod, and I'm here with Stefan Bradl, the LCR Honda MotoGP rider. 8th place today. It looked quite hard work out there, but you did, you know, another great show. On the season so far, first of all, you've come up as Moto2 champion. There must be some pressure with that. But you seem to have taken to this class really quickly. How different has it been? How difficult has it been?
Yeah, it's not easy. The change was quite big because, you know, you go with already some expectations to the MotoGP class. And but the change was bigger than I expected, especially because of with the electronic of the bike and the top riders, how precise they are in the whole race. And, you know, there you can make the difference. And this is the competition is really, really high.
Yeah, it's really obvious that the 20th of a second every corner adds up. It's Father's Day today. You've already overtaken your father Helmut's total number of wins. You're 7 to his 5. Is he happy for you? Or
there's no doubt. For sure he's happy. He was the proudest man, I think, of the world in that moment when I won the championship last year. And for sure he is supporting me every time.
Yeah, it's fantastic to see. One thing that you've developed a reputation for being a thinking racer. Are you thinking ahead 3-4 corners? Are you thinking about the whole race? Do you think about the championship whilst you're racing? Or is it
difficult
all in
to
the
say.
Moment?
It's difficult to say because some riders just do the move and don't think about it. And most of the time I try to think about it and then do the move. But in general, I cannot tell you when I will start to think about it. There are many things to go through your head in a race, and so it's not easy to speak about that because I don't know exactly right now. You have to make the decision in one second, less than 1 second.
Yeah, and it's got to be tough out there. I spoke to Lucio Ceccanello on Friday, and he was very, very clearly so happy that they've made the decision to bring you in. The fact you're on a 2-year contract, does that take some pressure off? Does that allow you more freedom to...
Does not change anything. I mean, I always try to do my best and to do the best for the team. For sure, I feel better if I have a 2-year contract, but that means nothing to me because I have to show my best on a track, and also this is my target to be as good as possible, and then automatically you get maybe better chances for a factory team, or you have to look around in the paddock.
Yeah, sure.
The results, I want to speak with my results.
Speaking of results, is there a particular racetrack you look forward to? Sachsenring obviously is your home round.
Yes, but it's not my favourite racetrack.
Right.
I'm really looking forward to racetracks for like Brno, Mugello. These racetracks are really big, good for MotoGP, and Phillip Island for sure. And but for sure we have to learn on every different, for me,
I have to learn every racetrack new because you have a completely different line on the MotoGP bike. But if we continue our progress and do another step forward, then we are really on plan.
Well, you're eighth in the World Championship, but you're only a few points behind Alvaro Bautista, who's in his third season, and Valentino Rossi, who, you know, speaks for itself. There's only ever been one German MotoGP winner at the top class in 74, Edmund Cisak, I believe.
Yes.
I've been talking to Dr. Martin Raines, the statistician, so I know these things. You are probably Germany's best chance for a MotoGP win. Obviously, that's what you'll be aiming for. Have you set yourself targets, or are you just trying to do the best you can at each round and see what happens?
Exactly, that's my plan. I don't think too much in statistics or something like this, because I'm living in reality. I'm living in the present. And then we'll see, because if one day we are having a great weekend and we have the chance to make a podium, then this is the best thing what can happen. And if one day we have a fantastic race and I can win the race, that will be even more fantastic. So I don't think about it. I hope it someday will happen, and I look forward to that.
Well, I'd like to wish you all the best for the rest of the season and beyond, Stefan. Thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you.
And the MotoPod, we've spoken to Lucio many times. LCR is a team that is very popular, yes, certainly with our listeners. It's a happy team, it's an effective team, and we wish you all the very best.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. So, thank you ever so much to Stefan Bradl. Absolutely charming old man. And again, like Dovi, raw talent can take you so far, but I do think to be a champion, you have to be able to think. And we think back to last year, and there was so much said about, oh, well, yeah, if Marquez hadn't got injured. Now, I still think Bradl would have won that championship because he has that racecraft. But it was fascinating to hear him say, I remember someone saying to Troy Bayliss, do you weight the outside peg or the inside peg when you corner? He said, I don't know. And I wish you hadn't asked me, because I might think about it now.
Exactly.
I just do what I do. And Stefan's like, yeah, I do think, but I don't know when that thought process starts. So his thinking is an instinctive thinking, which just makes him so much more dangerous. Mm-hmm. I don't mean that in the sense of, you know, safety dangerous, but
makes him
so much more competitive than someone who actually has to go, oh, I need to remember to think. I mean, interestingly, and just as a little aside on the thought process of races, Roger Thomas, one of our paramedics, was doing paramedic cover at the TT, and he got to chat to Guy Martin. And he said to him, you know, do you have a reason why you think you haven't won a race? And he went, yeah, I lose concentration. He said, by lap four, I'm wondering what I'm going to have for tea that night, and then I make a mistake, which I thought was ridiculously honest.
Yeah.
But it is, it's that thing of being able to focus on the corner coming up whilst having the capacity to think about the next three, who's behind you, who's in front, what the championship standings are. And it's not about riding for points, which often I think people are damned with faint praise when they say, oh, we can ride a good championship. Nicky's suffered from that. James Toseland suffered from it, you know, possibly with some justification. I don't think that at all. But like you said, he likes to think and then make the move. But yeah, I watch this kid. This kid is something special, I think.
Yeah, I agree. Big fan.
Yeah. So that was my weekend. We're gonna round up, and then to see us out, we'll have just a 4.5 minute chat with Ben Challenger and Ewan Thomas, Olympic athletes. And I would just like to reiterate, best of luck to Ben this Saturday. He's doing the Olympic qualifying event, and he's feeling bullishly confident, and fingers crossed. Because I think he is planning to retire after the Olympics, hopefully having competed in them. And Ewan's doing, Ewan could be seen doing commentary for Al Jazeera, who are doing some really, really good sports coverage, interestingly. And then we've got 2 minutes with Captain Johnny Cutler on the role of a motorsport event air ambulance.
Which I, by the way, found so funny how he's trying so hard to be the pilot. You know, the right stuff, the guy with the right stuff. Is he like that?
Johnny is an absolutely delightful chap. I've known him since I started flying. He was an engineer on in the army. Then he did his pilot's course. And John is an absolute diamond. But yeah, no, he is. If he's Johnny is, it can be in. He could be at the Queen's Garden party. He could be down the pub with his mates. He just has the same manner.
Nice.
And he transmits. He burst transmits information. But the guy's knowledge is encyclopedic. He's one of Sharon and mine's, you know, greatest friends. He's an absolutely lovely fella. And he's the only person I've ever met who talks more than me.
Wow.
So Johnny was like, "You want to interview me?"
Well, it's
how
good
long,
to know because that means that I'm never going to hang out with the two of you then, right?
No, it's not advisable. unless you're one of those guys who likes to catch, you know, 2-3 hour afternoon nap, wake up and hear the same conversation still going on.
Awesome.
But so we'll run those right at the end. But a little bit of news you've put in on World Superbikes.
We'll go into India in 2013. But let's say that for a future show. We'll talk about the actual circuit.
Sure.
It was a great getting updates from you during the weekend, and right on, man. And thanks very much.
Absolutely. Everyone, we'll speak to you next week.
Bye, ciao.
Good night. It's Martin here from MotoPod. We're outside in the paddock. We just had a fantastic Moto2 race, and with me is Ben Challenger. The listeners will remember we had Ben on earlier in the year. Mm-hmm. Ben, you've got your Olympic trials next week.
Yep.
But I guess for today, Dainese, you've got your couple of hospitality tickets. You come up to watch the MotoGP. So.
Yeah, well, you know, I generally like to focus immensely on my task at hand, but, you know, like yourself, probably, Martin, I find bikes relaxing. So amongst all this stressful running around and getting ready for the trials, you know, I spend a couple of hours down here at Silverstone and watch the bikes, chill out before the epic task of next week's trials.
Well, we all wish you very much the best for that. Any thoughts for this afternoon's race? Obviously, we've got an injured Cal Crutchlow.
Yeah, I'm gutted about that because, you know, I've been reading some of the media and been watching him in the last few races. He's really coming into form and finding his own. Got the best race we've probably had, maybe since Barry, eh? Who knows? We'll see.
Yeah, I think Ron Aslan might have something to say about that. But yeah.
I'm really, really looking forward to seeing the race. Obviously, if it rains, then that's going to change. The Catty boys might come through, which is a shame. So I think Cal would have probably come through as well. But yeah, front row's a bit odd, isn't it?
Yeah, the front row is a bit odd. We were watching it yesterday, and Alvaro Bautista very happy, but acknowledged that last 5 minutes when the guys put the soft tyres on go out was wiped out because it suddenly started to rain.
No, exactly, and I think it's going to be an interesting race and not one I would want to call.
No, but did you see the warm-up result this morning?
I didn't know. I was
in the dry.
Travelling up.
Nicky Hayden second.
Really?
Yeah, we had Alvaro, who's obviously the pole sitter, was sixth in warm-up.
Yeah.
We had Lorenzo quickest.
Yeah.
And then Nicky having a really, really good run in second on the dry warm-up. So
well, that's interesting.
Promising signs.
Well, it looks like they're coming, picking it around. Be interesting if Rossi takes his settings.
Of course, we're going to look like idiots if we plug all this too much because the race hasn't happened yet.
Exactly.
And then afterwards, everything can be different.
We'll be eating our hats, no doubt.
Yeah, fingers crossed we'll have a good run. Yeah. Ben, you come down with Ewan Thomas, another well-known British athlete. We're just going to say very quickly hello.
Hello there, all right?
Yeah, very good. And with us as well is your mate Charlie, who's come from Wars Harley-Davidson. Very well-known London-based Harley-Davidson dealer, and you do customising as well and all sorts, don't you?
Yeah.
So,
built him a bike?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've got a bike done by Charlie, yeah. So I've come on today.
Very nice. Very nice.
I'm showing you my crash helmet just for clarity for you there.
Yeah, yeah, that's
I'm
definitely
showing you my bike. I'm glad you like my leather helmet as well.
It is very nice, leather Harley Davidson helmet. So I presume that'll take you several days to get here from London on a Harley.
Believe it or not, I won't repeat how fast I was just going on it.
No, it's all right. I mean, it's legal speed. It's all right, yeah, of course. Legal speed there.
No, I enjoy it. It's a bit slower, obviously, than a sports bike, but it's got a real nice retro feel to it, and it looks wicked. I love it.
And at least the weather's come out for us today.
Well, yeah, that's it. It'll be interesting if it stays that way. Well, something's going to change the racing, but I don't know. There's a part of me would actually like to see it rain. I don't know.
Yeah, I think. I mean, certainly the
ride. I'm saying that. But
no, but I think the riders. If it's going to be wet, be wet. If it's going to be dry, be dry. And this is obviously one thing they're looking at with reducing to a one bike rule for next season.
Yeah, yeah.
When we get the flag to flag, it has its own excitement. They come in, they jump from one bike onto the other.
Yeah, yeah.
If they're down to one bike, you're talking. I don't know how fast one of these teams could change tyres, but imagine it's 30, 45 seconds.
Really? Yeah.
And then
if
a mechanic,
you do that, you've had it really.
Yeah. Okay, well, the air show's about to start, so there goes the neighbourhood.
Yeah, that's not Ewan's
bike. No. I think we'll wrap this one up.
Oh, brilliant.
Have a great race. Lovely to meet you, Ben.
Yeah, and too nice to put a face to all the emails in chats and stuff.
Yeah, so, and yeah. We'll speak again soon.
I hope so, because I enjoy it.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, mate.
Hi, it's Martin from Motopod. It's Saturday morning, and on my way into the media centre, I've dropped by the medical centre, where we've got Captain Johnny Cutler, one of our guys, regularly works up at Welshpool with us on the air ambulance, and our company, Bond Air Services, have the contract for Silverstone, and Johnny's cop lucky and he's down here for the MotoGP weekend. Morning, Johnny.
Good morning, Martin.
Right, so we've got one of our air ambulance helicopters here. There's extensive medical crew inside, and basically you're here in case you're needed to airlift a rider to hospital. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely, as I understand things. The essence of what we're doing here, we're providing a rapid response in the event somebody has a fairly severe or serious injury. We can provide very quick and rapid medical transportation to a hospital with medical crews. Unfortunately, we're not constituted as a HEMS crew, which would be the sort of typical crewing that you'd expect for an air ambulance. However, we've got doctors, anaesthetists, nurses, paramedics, some of you. So we would expect to have at least two crew and transport to the nearest hospitals. Probably things like John Radcliffe, 10 minutes flying away, or something potentially like the QE in Birmingham.
Yeah, and John Radcliffe at Oxford is a very good trauma centre, isn't it? Queen Elizabeth at Birmingham, another good one. So we're not too far from either. The only downside would be if the helicopter deploys, I believe that racing would have to cease until it came back.
I've heard this, I don't know it firsthand, so I couldn't put hand on heart and actually say that, but that's what I've been told. My understanding is that it's an FIA requirement, and my view, and probably a very good one, that is an option. However, also, I guess they still could call on an external air ambulance should it be required, and my view, which would still leave us free then to cover the remainder of the racing, and my view. But again, I couldn't really put hand on heart, it's a bit above my pay band. I'm just here to fly the helicopter.
Yeah, no, I believe when Rossi was flown out of Mugello, they actually brought in an external air ambulance, which is why practice was able to continue whilst he was flown away. But hopefully we won't be needing you this weekend. Fingers crossed, and you'll have a quiet one with that interesting bunch of medics in there. They can't hear us, so it's all right to talk about them. But Johnny, thanks very much, and no doubt I'll pop by for a brew again later on. I'm going to finish this coffee. Cheers.
Absolute pleasure. Cheers.